Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
You from a viewer who asks, how have you been able to balance the role of a spokesperson on racial issues on the one hand and artist on the other?
Those two go together for me. I don't find them different at all. I think art should be political, representative, and absolutely and irrevocably beautiful at the same time.
This one's a little complicated. Pearl Duncan from New York. I remember the question by a reporter in your answer when you were asked why you don't feature white characters more prominently in your works. Now it's in the news that African Americans will soon be able to use DNA to trace their ancestors to Africa. Not only will African Americans discover their African ancestors, but they will uncover white ancestors as specific people from specific nations. I wonder how African-American writers will respond to these ancestors, et cetera. I mean, it's the technology informing who we are.
Yeah, the reporter's question was certainly not about that. It was a routine, predictable question about why doesn't a black writer write about white people? I thought it was silly and ridiculous. Nobody ever asked a white writer why he didn't write about black people, because it's a non-literary question, and it's fundamentally a stupid one. So I was responding to what I knew was the encouragement of a reporter to make me comment on the sociological aspect of being an artist, not the art itself. But as you just suggested, I mean, people should be able to write about anything they want. I mean, anything, anybody. All you have to do is know it. I should be able to write about Chinese people. And what would prevent me from doing it is I don't know anything about it. And I haven't respected their history enough to do the research on it. I have only listened to superficials. I mean, you know, that kind of thing would prevent me. It's the same kind of thing I would expect if white writers write about black people. All you have to do is respect the people you're writing about, get interested enough, not use it as a, you know, harangue, and it's entirely open. This is not a ghetto world that art lives in.
Context of white supremacy. Mr. Fuller says, if you are classified as black, you are the ghetto. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, October 10, 2019. So I have been told this is our book study, our seventh study session on the late, the legend, Toni Morrison's Tar Baby. We are picking up in chapter 9. So from last week, we had Valerian and Margaret Street, whites, racists, still dealing with the fallout from the revelation, put that in quotes, of Margaret's child abuse, that she had been beating their white son, Michael, when he was a young baby. And I thought it was so important, Toni Morrison talking about innocence last week, and particularly white innocence as it relates to Valerian. And him saying, well, I didn't know, when he's going through all this and he's upset. Oh, I care about my child. This is my son. How could you do this? And I didn't know if I'd only known. And she really eloquently breaks down the deception. In fact, she labels it. She says the most sinful, the most guilty person is the so-called innocent. Well, you didn't know what was happening with all of this. You saw some of the signs, but you didn't investigate. You didn't want to know. And comparing that to white people's role in the system of white supremacy, I just say what I said last week. White people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and it's not even at the Valerian level. They are very super well informed. It would be like Valerian sitting there watching her do all the burning and then trying to come around, burn the child with cigarette and everything else. And then he turns and says, what? What do you mean? You've been abused. What? I never. Get out of here. Get out of here. One point I also want to make that I thought was so important for so many reasons. I think I've been saying, I think there's some really solid, substantial critiques of white people and how they practice racism in the texture of this book, if you pay attention. But I think it's important. One of the reviews that I read, they said that this book is Toni Morrison's least like scholarly read book. Like, this is the one that critics have the fewest reviews of and interpretations. It's the book of hers that is least taught in schools. And I thought, wow, I hadn't read this book before. We're reading it now either. I thought, wow, like The Bluest Eyes taught in school and Beloved and Song of Solomon, all these other books that she's written. But they said not this one. So I said, we should think about that as we're proceeding. This is, I think, one of the few Toni Morrison books that has prominent white characters. I haven't read every book that she's written. Enormous body of work. But I don't remember there being prominent white characters who are like an integral part of the storyline, and they're complex. And you get all this background information like the streets. I don't remember that from The Bluest Eye, and it's been a while since I've read Beloved, some of her other works, but I don't remember that. Maybe that's why this book is not so popular. And in particular, I think of how popular Beloved is. Oprah's book club, and they made the movie and put Danny Glover in it and all that. And that's, you know, still taught in schools. I think that might be, if I had to guess, I think Beloved is Toni Morrison's most popular book. Tell us all about, you know, the enslaved Negroes, and tell us all about how she killed her child. Oh, we want to see that on the big screen. Yes, yes, yes. More Negro trauma drama. But this one, where it's whites beating their children. I just thought about that comparison. Why not put those together? Looking at, you got two different examples of parents enacting violence against their offspring. Why not put those together? Literary comparison. Why wouldn't that be the case? Just something to think about. Again, this is supposed to be one of her least popular book. I'm not talking about sales, but they're just talking about in terms of books that are taught in class. You look and see people that do reviews and all of that, reports about her writing and what it means that this is one of the least selected. What does that mean? Keep that in mind, because we only have one session left. We'll be done. One session left. We'll be done with this text next Friday. With that, we will begin. This is The Context of White Supremacy, Toni Morrison's Tar Baby, audio segment number one. We are picking up in chapter 9.
Jadeen was squatting down in the middle of the road, the afternoon sun at her back. The children were happy to pose, and so were some of the younger women. Only the old folks refused to smile and glared into her camera as though looking at hell with the lid off. The men were enjoying the crease in her behind so clearly defined in the sunlight. Click, click. Jadeen had remembered her camera just before she thought she would go nuts trying to keep a conversation going with Ellen and the neighbor women who came in to see Son's northern girl. They looked at her with outright admiration, each one saying, "I was in Baltimore once," or, "My cousin, she live in New York." They did not ask her what they really wanted to know. Where did she know Son from, and how much did her boots cost? Jadeen smiled, drank glasses of water, and tried to talk down home like Ondine. But their worshipful stares and non-conversation made Son's absence seem much too long. She was getting annoyed when she remembered her camera. Now she was having a ball photographing everybody. Soldier's Yard was full. "Beautiful," she said. "Fantastic. Now over here." Click, click. "Hey, what'd you say your name was?" "Okay, Beatrice. Could you lean up against the tree?" Click, click. "This way. Beautiful. Hold it. Hold it. Heaven. Click, 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 click. Sun didn't mean to snatch it, just to end it somehow. Stop the crease, the sunlight, the click, click, click. And when he did, she looked at him with confusion at first, then with evolved anger. What's the matter with you? It wasn't nice to snatch the camera and then to have to tell her about the sleeping arrangements. It wasn't nice. Not nice at all. He took her to Old Man's, and after supper there, to Rosa's. Drake and Soldier picked them up and drove them to a joint in Ponce called Night Moves, where there was live music, barbecue sandwiches, and unrestrained dancing under four blue lights that neither flashed or strobed. They even managed some snatch in the car, Jadine under the impression that nobody knew, he aware that everybody did. The back seat turned her volume up, but the beer and the bad whiskey made her so sleepy there was no problem when he left her at Rosa's. She slept like a boulder for 3 hours, then woke, missing him, and suffocating in that little bedroom without windows. She sat up naked, for she never wore nightgowns, and held her shoulders. The room had a door to the living room and one that opened to the backyard. She opened the latter and looked out into the blackest nothing she had ever seen. Blacker and bleaker than Ile des Chevaliers, and loud. Loud with the presence of plants and field life. If she was wanting air, there wasn't any. It's not possible, she thought, for anything to be this black. Maybe if she stood there long enough, light would come from somewhere, and she could see shadows, the outline of something, a bush, a tree, a line between earth and sky, a heavier darkness to show where this very house stopped and space began. She remembered the blackness she saw when Sun told her to close her eyes and to put a star in it. That would be the only way it would get there, she thought, for the world in the direction of the sky, in that place where the sky ought to be, was starless. Haze, she guessed. There must be haze in the sky. Otherwise, there would be a moon, at the least. The loudness of the plants was not audible, but it was strong nonetheless. She might as well have been in a cave, a grave, the dark womb of the earth, suffocating with the sound of plant life moving, but deprived of its sight. She could see nothing and could not remember what she had seen when it was daylight. A movement behind made her jump and turn around. Rosa was standing in the inner doorway, lit from behind by a lamp. Anything the matter? I heard you moving around. Jadine closed the back door. The lamplight from the other door was weak, but it was healthy enough to spotlight her nakedness. Rosa gazed down Jadine's body with a small bowing of her head and then up again. Her eyes traveled slowly, moving like one of those growing plants Jadine could not see, but whose presence was cracking loud. Why didn't you tell me you didn't have no night clothes? I got something I can let you have, Rosa said. I forgot, said Jadine. I forgot to bring anything. I'll get you something. When Rosa came back, Jadine was in the bed. Rosa handed her a kind of slip, wrinkled but clean-smelling. You all right, daughter? Oh, I'm fine. I just got too warm and wanted some air, Jadine answered. This used to be a porch. I made it into an extra room, but it does heat up. I didn't feel like buying no windows. Can you leave the back door open? Asked Jadine. I wouldn't advise it. Anything at all might come in here out of those trees. I got a little old electric fan I'll get you. No, no, don't bother. You sure? Yes. It's beat up, but it stirs the air around. It's okay. Well, I'll leave this here door open. Rosa propped a wooden slat-back chair against the inner door. Sorry, she said. That gown ain't much, but it'll cover you. Thanks, said Jadine, but it didn't cover her. She lay down in the slip under the sheet and her nakedness before Rosa lay down with her. No man had made her feel that naked, that unclothed. Lyrers, lovers, doctors, artists, none of them had made her feel exposed. More than exposed. Obscene. God, Elo. They were leaving Sunday. Surely she could get through a Sunday, and then she and Sun would be back on the train holding hands, and then on the airplane playing with each other under the Delta Airlines blanket, their faces serene as passengers, their hands devious and directed. She fell asleep on that thought and woke at 10:30 with Rose's fingertips tapping her on the shoulder. "Sun's in there," she said. "You all going to eat with me, ain't you?" Jadine got up and dressed quickly. He was sitting at the table, looking more beautiful than after the first haircut on Ile des Chevaliers, more beautiful than when he stood at the piano with his coat over his shoulder and she saw Savannah's in his face, more beautiful than on the beach when he touched her foot, than when he opened the door to his room at the Hilton. She wanted to sit in his lap, but Drake and Soldier were at the table too, so she just walked over and put her hand on his head. He smiled up at her and kissed the palm of her other hand. Drake and Soldier looked bathed and glittery. They beamed at Sun with the same adoration she did, but they didn't compete. They sat back and enjoyed his presence and his prize woman. They looked at him with love and looked at her like she was a Cadillac he had won, or stolen, or even bought for all they knew. "You all getting hitched?" Soldier asked. They were alone in the house while Sun and Drake drove Rosa to church. "I guess so," Jadine answered. "We haven't talked about it." "He's good. You ought to snatch him." She laughed. "Should I?" "Damn right. You don't, somebody else sure will. He was married before, you know." "I know. Never should have married that woman, that Cheyenne. Every one of us told him that, or tried to, but he did it anyway to his grief and sorrow." "Was she pretty?" asked Jadine. She didn't want to ask it, but it seemed extremely important to know the answer. "Nah, I wouldn't say pretty. Not bad looking, mind, but nothing like pretty." "He must have loved her, though." "That could be what it was." Soldier sounded as though there were some doubts. "Nah," he said. "She wasn't pretty, but you had to hand it to her, though. She had the best pussy in Florida, the absolute best." And he turned his eyes on Jadine as if to say, "Now top that." It wasn't nice. Not nice at all. Sun embarrassed her in the road with the camera. Rosa made her feel like a slut. And now Soldier was trying to make her feel like a virgin competing with... She didn't answer him, so he went on. "You ever been married?" "No," she said, and looked squarely in his face, thinking, if he says, "good-looking woman like you ought to be able," she would smack him in the mouth. But all he said was, "Too bad." And that didn't seem definite enough to break his face for. "Any children?" "You ask too many questions," she said. "Anything you want to know about me, ask Son." Soldier smiled at that and shook his head. "Son don't talk about his women, and don't let nobody else talk about them either." "I'm glad of that," she said. "I ain't. Keeps him dumb. He wouldn't know a good woman from a snake, and he won't let nobody point out the difference." "Can he tell the difference between a good man and a snake?" "Oh, yeah. Son knows people. He just get confused when it comes to women. With most everything else, he thinks with his heart. But when it comes to women, he thinks with his dick. You know what I mean?" "Some people think with their mouths." "Yeah, I guess you're right about that," Soldier smiled. "But maybe it's better not thinking at all." "How would you know?" she asked him. He laughed. "You a hot one, ain't you?" "Yes, I'm a hot one." "Yeah." He ran his fingers over the place on his head where his hair was thinning. "A hot one, all right, and a live one, too." "Believe it." She got up to pour herself more coffee. Soldier scanned her hips. "Can I ask you something?" What? Who's controlling it? Controlling what? The thing. The thing between you two. Who's in control? Nobody. We're together. Nobody controls anybody, she said. Good, he said. That's real good. Son, he don't like control. Makes him, you know, wild-like. We don't have that kind of relationship. I don't like to be controlled either. But you like to have it, don't you? Not with him. Good, good. Did Cheyenne have control? She sat down and stirred air into her coffee. Cheyenne? Nah, she didn't control nothing, at least not during the day. But good God, she sure did run the nights. He laughed, and then, since she did not join in, he sobered quickly and asked, How long you all planning to stay around? Jadine repressed a smile. He'd lost and wanted her out of town. We're leaving today. Today? You can't leave today. Why not? Ernie Paul is coming. We called him up. He left from Montgomery already. Be here Monday. Soldier was alarmed. Who's Ernie Paul? He's one of us. Grew up with Son and Drake and me. He's taken off work to come down and see Son and all of us. TKO, thought Jadine, but she didn't hang up her gloves. When Son got back, she showed him the train schedule. One more night, baby, he said. I can't. Not in that room. Not alone. Come on. No, Son. Not unless you stay with me. I can't do that. Then I'm leaving. I'm long past 14. Okay, look. After church, when Rosa gets back, we'll go for a ride. Son, listen now. Let me show you this county. Bring your camera. Then tonight, you go back to Rosa's. Son, wait. Leave the back door open. I'll come in and stay with you all night. And in the morning, I'll go around the front like I just got there. You promise? I promise. Paleolithic, she thought. I am stuck here with a pack of Neanderthals who think sex is dirty or strange or something, and he is standing here almost 30 years old doing it too. Stupid. Stupid, she said aloud. I know, but that's the way they are. What do you want me to do? You think anything we do is going to change them? I want us to be honest. Can't we be gentle first and honest later? Accommodating beyond all belief. Because it was his hometown and his people, she supposed. She photographed everything during the ride until she was out of film. They found sheds and orchards to make love in and an open window of a schoolhouse with a teacher's desk wide enough for two. They got back to Elo at 8 and stayed out as late as they could when night moves closed, then gave everybody a ride home. When Jadine got to Rosa's, she put on the wrinkled slip to amuse him when he returned, unlatched the door, and got in the bed. Half an hour later, he was there. She had been listening carefully, so she heard the swing of the door. Son? Yeah. Hurry up. He hurried. Something was in his hand as he knelt by the bed, leaves or fern or something. He made her take the slip off, and he brushed her all over with the fern, and she tried not to moan or laugh or cry out while he was saying, shh, shh. He undressed and climbed in. Jadine opened her arms to this man accustomed to the best pussy in Florida. It must have been that thought put there by Soldier that made her competitive, made her struggle to outdo Cheyenne and surpass her legendary gifts. She was thinking of her, whipped on by her, and that, perhaps, plus the fact that she had left the door unlatched and Son had opened it on its hinges, and after it was open on its hinges, it stayed wide open, but they had not noticed because they were paying attention only to each other, so that must have been why and how Cheyenne got in, and then the rest. Rosa and Therese and Son's dead mother and Sally Sarah Sadie Brown and Ondine and Soldier's wife Ellen, and Francine from the mental institution, and her own dead mother, and even the woman in yellow, all there crowding into the room. Some of them she did not know, recognize, but they were all there spoiling her lovemaking, taking away her sex like succubi, but not his. He fell asleep and didn't see the women in the room, and she didn't either, but they were there crowding each other and watching her, pushing each other, nudging for space. They poured out of the dark like ants out of a hive. She shook Sun, and he woke, saying, "Huh?" And she said, "Shouldn't you close the door?" Because she didn't want to say, "There are women in the room. I can't see them, but this room is full of women." He said, "Yeah," and went back to sleep. She just lay there, too frightened to do it herself, for then she would have to walk through the crowd of women standing in the pitch-dark room, whom she could not see, but would have to touch to get through them. And she felt them nudging each other for a better look at her, until finally being frightened was worse than anything they could do to her, so she got mad and sat up. Her voice was half as loud as her heart. "What do you want with me, goddammit?" They looked as though they had just been waiting for that question, and they each pulled out a breast and showed it to her. Jadine started to tremble. They stood around in the room, jostling each other gently. Gently. There wasn't much room, revealing one breast and then two, and Jadine was shocked. This was not the dream of Hats, for in that she was asleep, her eyes closed. Here she was wide awake, but in total darkness, looking at her own mother, for God's sake, and Nana Dean. "I have breasts too," she said, or thought, or willed. "I have breasts too." But they didn't believe her. They just held their own higher and pushed their own farther out and looked at her, all of them revealing both their breasts except the woman in yellow. She did something more shocking. She stretched out a long arm and showed Jadine her three big eggs. It scared her so she began to cry. Her back pressed hard, hard into the wall, her right hand in a ball over her stomach. She shook Sun and shook him some more. When he stirred and woke, she slammed her face into his shoulder, crying. "What is it? What's going on? Tell them to leave me alone." "What?" "Hold me." "Jadine." "Shut the door." "No, don't move. Hold me." "Those hats again?" "No." "What?" "Hold me." And he did, till morning, even while he slept and she didn't, and the women finally went away, sighing. He did not let her go. Nobody was fooled by that little charade. Old man guessed, the men knew, and Rosa heard them as clear as the radio. She couldn't shake it. Not because Rosa fried eggs in the morning, or even the camera business, or soldier's big mouth, or old man's phony biblical conversation, or the wrinkled slip in the stuffy room, but the possibility of more plant sounds in the cave and the certainty of the night women kept her nervous. She couldn't shake it. The women in the night had killed the whole weekend. Elo was rotten and more boring than ever. A burnt-out place. There was no life there. Maybe a past, but definitely no future, and finally there was no interest. All that southern small-town country romanticism was a lie, a joke, kept secret by people who could not function elsewhere, an excuse to fish. Ernie Paul could come to New York, faster even if he flew. She needed air and taxicabs and conversation in a language she understood. She didn't want to have any more discussions in which the silences meant more than the words did. And no, she didn't want to party at night moves, son. Please get me out of here. "You know I have things to do. Take me back, or I'll go back and you stay, or go. But son, I'm not spending another night here." "I'll come to you again tonight." "It doesn't help." "We'll stay out all night." "No, just get me to the train on time." Sun closed the eyes inside his eyes to her for a minute, the way he had in the bedroom when he had come in without knocking, closed them without shutting them. She was making him choose. But he opened them again and asked her, "You love me?" "I love you," she said. "Will you be there when I get there?" "I'll be there. Of course I'll be there. Waiting." "Ernie Paul has a car. I'll go back to Montgomery with him tomorrow and fly from there to New York." "Okay. No longer?" "No longer. I love you. I love you." They got to the train on time, but he didn't get to New York on time. 4 days passed, and he still had not come. Jadine was not disturbed. There was so much to do, errands and lunches and hair appointments and jobs. She had to call Dawn to see if she was coming back as planned. Did she have to find another place? On the fifth day, she was feeling orphaned again. He could have called. She imagined him carousing with Ernie Paul and Soldier. Then another weekend rolled by, and still no son. Apparently, he knew how to call Ernie Paul, but not how to call her. She thought of calling Elo. There was a telephone in Night Moves, but she couldn't remember whether she'd seen one in any of the houses. Now she was biting mad at his carelessness, his indifference. Then she got desperate. In her heart, she knew he would come, sometime, and that he would have either a good excuse or no excuse at all, but she knew that he would come. The desperation came from the sense she had of his being down there with all those women with their breasts and eggs, the bitches. All the women in his life and in hers were down there. Well, not all the women in her life. Dawn wasn't there, and neither was Aisha, or Felicity, or Betty. They wouldn't have done that to her anyway. They were her friends. They were like her. Not like old Cheyenne with the statewide pussy, or Rosa with the witness eyes, or Nana Dean with the tight-fisted braids, looking sorrowful at the kitchen table and accusatory in that room. And not like Francine, attacked by dogs and driven crazy, or even like her own mother. "How could you, Mama? How could you be with them? You left me. You died. You didn't care enough about me to stay alive. You knew Daddy was gone, and you went too." But she had rerun that movie so many times, its zazz was gone, leaving only technique to admire. Of course her mother was with them, showing her boobs. Of course she would be there. But what made them think they could all get together to do that to her? They didn't even know each other. What did they have in common, even, besides the breasts? She had breasts. So did Dawn and Aisha and Felicity and Betty. But she couldn't shake it, and it kept her angry. And the anger was good for the photographers and the agency and the telephone company and the apartment managers. Everybody took notice and got out of the way. Dawn said May 15th. She would be back then. Jadine asked around about another sublet and found two. One a house for 1 month, June. Another an apartment for 6 months, but it was way uptown. Then a loft she could share for 2 weeks and keep for the summer. Every night she went to bed too exhausted to worry. Only on waking did it come back, fresher each time, heavier, till finally she sat with a glass of grapefruit juice in her hand in the morning, and since she could not shake it, she decided to reel it in. Cut off its head, slice it open and see what lay in its belly. The women had looked awful to her, onion heels, pot bellies, hair surrendered to rags and braids. And the breasts they thrust at her like weapons were soft, loose bags closed at the tip with a brunette eye. Then the slithery black arm of the woman in yellow stretching 12 feet, 15, toward her and the fingers that fingered eggs. It hurt, and part of the hurt was in having the vision at all, at being the helpless victim of a dream that chose you. Some was the frontal sorrow of being publicly humiliated by those you had loved or thought kindly toward. A little bitty hurt that was always gleaming when you looked at it. So you covered it over with a lid until the next time. But most of the hurt was dread. The night women were not merely against her, and her alone, not him, not merely looking superior over their sagging breasts and folded stomachs. They seemed somehow in agreement with each other about her, and were all out to get her, tie her, bind her, grab the person she had worked hard to become and choke it off with their soft, loose tits. Jadine sipped the grapefruit juice. Its clean, light acid dissolved the morning cloud from her tongue. No, Rosa, I am not your daughter, and he is not your son. When Sun got back, she fought him. In between the sweet times, she fought him. He thought she was fighting him about Ernie Paul and being late and not calling. She thought so too, part of the time. But most of the time, she knew she was fighting the night women, the mamas who had seduced him and were trying to lay claim to her. It would be the fight of their lives to get away from that coven that had nothing to show but breasts. He needed a job, a degree, she said. They should go in business for themselves. He should enroll in business school. He had 2 semesters of Florida A&M. Maybe he could pass the LSAT. He should take the SAT, the GRE, the CEE. You can go to law school, she said. I don't want to be a lawyer, he said. Why? She asked. Think, he said. Why? Think. Why? I can't hassle nobody that looks like me or you either. Oh, shit, there's other kinds of law. No, there isn't. Besides, I don't want to know their laws. I want to know mine. You don't have any. Then that's the problem with it. She fought him, but she never mentioned the night women. They fought instead about Valerian Street. He would lend them the money to open a shop or start an agency. Sun said, no way, and I am not about to sit here and argue about that white man. Who cares what color he is? I care, and he cares. He cares what color he is. He's a person, not a white man. He put me through school. You have told me that 1,000,000 times. Why not educate you? You did what you were told, didn't you? Undine and Sydney were obedient, weren't they? White people love obedience, love it. Did he do anything hard for you? Did he give up anything important for you? He wasn't required to, but maybe he would have since he was not required to educate me. That was toilet paper, Jadine. He should have wiped his ass after he shit all over your uncle and aunt. He was required to. He still is. His debt is big, woman. He can't never pay it off. He educated me, Jadine was shouting, and you can't make me think that was not an important thing to do, because nobody else did. Nobody else did. You didn't. What do you mean I didn't? I mean you didn't. You didn't. She slapped him, and before he could turn his head back, she was choking him with both hands around his neck, screaming all the while, you didn't, you didn't. He pulled her hair until she let go, and when she tried another blow, he dropped her as carefully as he could. She fell back on her behind, turned over, and crawled on all fours to jump him again. He held her arms behind her back, and she bit him to his teeth. The pain was so powerful, he had to put out her light with his fist. When she came to and touched her jaw, he went wild thinking he had loosened one of the side teeth so precious to him. Jadine dressed the bite marks on his face, and they said Ali Balin, laughing as best they could with the bruises. Sometimes they argued about school. Maybe that was the problem. It's bullshit, Jadine. It is not. When will you listen to the truth? What truth? The truth that while you were playing the piano in the Night Moves Cafe, I was in school. The truth is that while you were driving your car into your wife's bed, I was being educated. While you were hiding from a small-town sheriff or some insurance company, hiding from a rap a 2-bit lawyer could have gotten you out of, I was being educated. I was working. I was making something out of my life. I was learning how to make it in this world, the one we live in, not the one in your head, not that dump, Elo. This world. And the truth is, I could not have done that without the help and care of some poor old white dude who thought I had brains enough to learn something. Stop loving your ignorance. It isn't lovable. Son picked her up and took her to the window. After a violent struggle, he actually held her out of it by her wrists, shouting. The truth is that whatever you learned in those colleges that didn't include me ain't shit. What did they teach you about me? What tests did they give? Did they tell you what I was like? Did they tell you what was on my mind? Did they describe me to you? Did they tell you what was in my heart? If they didn't teach you that, then they didn't teach you nothing, because until you know about me, you don't know nothing about yourself. And you don't know anything at all about your children, and anything at all about your mama and your papa. You find out about me, you educated nitwit. It was only 10 feet off the ground, and she wet her pants, but still she hollered loud enough for him to hear, as well as the few people gathered on the sidewalk to watch. You want to be a yard man all your life? His name is Gideon. Gideon, not yard man. And Mary Therese Foucault, you hear me? Why don't you ask me to help you buy a house and put your aunt and uncle in it and take that woman off her feet? Her feet are killing her. And let them live like people for a change, like the people you never studied, like the people you can't photograph. They are the ones who put you through school, woman. They are the ones, not him. They worked for him all their lives, and you left them down there with him not knowing if they had a job or not. You should cook for them. What the hell kind of education is it that didn't teach you about Gideon, an old man, and me? Nothing about me. When he pulled her back in, her arms were so sore she could not move them. But she was curled up teary-eyed in his lap an hour later when the doorbell rang. Son was massaging her shoulders and begging forgiveness. They both went to the door and looked so lovey-dovey, the police thought they had the wrong apartment. It must have been somebody else throwing a woman out of the window. Other times they fought about work. Surely that was the problem. He mentioned once wanting to go back to the boats. You can't. You're blacklisted. You jumped ship, remember? That don't mean nothing. You'll be away all the time. Why do you want to leave me? I don't. But we don't have to live here. We can live anywhere. You mean Elo. I mean anywhere. I can get good work in other places. Where? Houston, Montgomery, Atlanta, San Diego? I can't live there. Why do you want to change me? Why do you want to change me? I want to live, not change. I can't live just for this goddamn city. Is it because you're afraid? Because you can't make it in New York? Make it in New York. Make it in New York. I'm tired of hearing that shit. What the fuck is it? If I make it in New York, then that's all I do. Make it in New York. That's not life. That's making it. I don't want to make it. I want to be it. New York ain't hard, baby. Not really hard. It's just sad. And what you need to make it here is the easy stuff I got rid of a long time ago. I've lived all over the world, Jadeen. I can live anywhere. You've never lived anywhere. And you? Where have you lived? Anybody ask you where you from, you give them 5 towns. You're not from anywhere. I'm from Elo. I hate Elo, and Elo hates me. Never was any feeling more mutual. She kept him on the defensive, demanded clarity, precision, very specific solutions to open-ended problems, and any furry notion he had in mind of what to do or where to do it matted before her rake-like intellect. He wanted to do things in time. She wanted them done on time. So he let her make private appointments, did take the SAT, and scored in the 400s, the LET, and was below the 13th percentile, the IRE, and ranked above the 80th percentile, the CEE, and scored in the 600s. That proves, he told her, that I can sit still for 3 hours at a clip, but I always knew that. One of two things, she said finally, either you go to school while I work, or we ask Valerian to invest in a business. Will you marry me? Yes. Okay. Okay, what? I'll go to school. Ooh-wee! She grabbed him around the neck and pulled him to the floor. But not here. Why? We're living in other people's space. This is not our crib. Let's go someplace else. How many times do I have to tell you, I can't work someplace else? You can, but I can't. What the hell do you do that's so jive you can't take it out of the city and do it there? I pay the bills is what I do. It was August. Jadine had sent for applications to CUNY and SUNY. When they came, she sat down and filled them out. She was tired and looking tired. So much so the agency people were skipping her. That 25-year-old face looked 26, and she had not been keeping up the regimen that held her at the 20-year-old peak. 17-year-old girls were getting the jobs. In Europe, they liked older-looking black models, but in the U.S., the look was 12. Soon, she would really have to call her old professor. The modeling thing was going bust fast. She'd make all she could as fast as she could, since it was 7 times what teaching would bring. She sat at the table, perspiring a little, filling out Sun's application. You'd think he would at least do that. Sun was watching her. She was a model of industry and planning. Every now and then she asked him a question, and they agreed on whether to lie or tell the truth. He watched her. There is the power, he thought, right there. That is all the power there is or ever will be, and I don't want any of it. She always referred to Elo as his cradle, as though living there was child's play, easy. As though living anywhere outside the first cities of the world was kiddie stuff. Well, it hadn't been easy for Francine, and it hadn't been easy for Rosa or his mother. Not easy at all. It was hard, and he believed it scared her to think of how hard. She thought this was hard. New York. She was scared of being still, of not being busy, scared to have to be quiet, scared to have children alone. He tried to imagine what kind of woman she would be in 50 years. Would she be Therese, or Ondine, or Rosa, or Sally Brown, or maybe even Francine, frail as a pick, tearing all her hair out in the state hospital? Bald. Bald Francine. Some cradle. It took all the grown-up strength you had to stay there and stay alive and keep a family together. They didn't know about state aid in Elo. There were no welfare lines in Elo, and unemployment insurance was a year of trouble with no rewards. She kept barking at him about equality, sexual equality, as though he thought women were inferior. He couldn't understand that. Before Francine was attacked by the dogs, she gave him 10 points on the court and still beat him. It was her athletic skill that caused her trouble. She was running in the fields and went too far. Some dogs, tracking an escaped convict, frustrated at having lost the scent, attacked her. 60 seconds later, the police got them off her and took her home. She stayed nervous after that. Well, nervous was what they all called it. But God, that girl could run. Cheyenne was driving a beat-up old truck at age 9, 4 years before he could even shift gears. And she could drop a pheasant like an Indian. His mother's memory was kept alive by those who remembered how she roped horses when she was a girl. His grandmother built a whole cow shed with only Rosa to help. In fact, the room Jadine had slept in, Rosa built herself, which was why it didn't have any windows. Anybody who thought women were inferior didn't come out of North Florida. On September 16th, 2 weeks before registration, a dividend came in the mail, $1,246 from the 4 municipal bond certificates Valerian had given her one Christmas when she was 16. She was delighted. It would take care of the school expenses. Sun said no. Valerian educated her, all right. There was nothing to be done about that. But he would not let him finance his own education. Jadine dropped her hands to her side with sheer exhaustion. Valerian is not the problem. Her voice was faint, gooey with repetition. This rescue was not going well. She thought she was rescuing him from the night women who wanted him for themselves, wanted him feeling superior in a cradle, deferring to him, wanted her to settle for wifely competence when she could be almighty, to settle for fertility rather than originality, nurturing instead of building. He thought he was rescuing her from Valerian, meaning them, the aliens, the people who in a mere 300 years had killed a world millions of years old. From Micronesia to Liverpool, from Kentucky to Dresden, they killed everything they touched, including their own coastlines, their own hills and forests. And even when some of them built something nice and human, they grew vicious protecting it from their own predatory children, let alone an outsider. Each was pulling the other away from the maw of hell, its very ridge top. Each knew the world as it was meant or ought to be. One had a past, the other a future, and each one bore the culture to save the race in his hands. Mama spoiled black man, will you mature with me? Culture-bearing black woman, whose culture are you bearing? Correct, he said. The problem is not Valerian. The problem is me. Solve it. With me or without me. But solve it because it ain't going anywhere. You sweep me under the rug and your children will cut your throat. That fucker in Europe, the one you were thinking about marrying, go have his children. That should suit you. Then you can do exactly what you bitches have always done. Take care of white folks' children. Feed, love, and care for white people's children. That's what you were born for. That's what you have waited for all your life. So have that white man's baby. That's your job. You have been doing it for 200 years. You can do it for 200 more. There are no mixed marriages. It just looks that way. People don't mix races. They abandon them or pick them. But I want to tell you something. If you have a white man's baby, you have chosen to be just another mammy, only you are the real mammy because you had it in your womb, and you are still taking care of white folks' children. Fat or skinny, head rag or wig, cook or model, you take care of white folks' babies. That's what you do. And when you don't have any white man's baby to take care of, you make one out of the babies black men give you. You turn little black babies into little white ones. You turn your black brothers into white brothers. You turn your men into white men. And when a black woman treats me like what I am, what I really am, you say she's spoiling me. You think I won't do all that company shit because I don't know how? I can do anything. Anything. But I'll be goddamn if I'll do that. She looked at him, and when he saw the sheen gone from her minky eyes and her wonderful mouth fat with disgust, he tore open his shirt, saying, I got a story for you. Get out of my face. You'll like it. It's short and to the point. Don't touch me. Don't you touch me. Once upon a time, there was a farmer, a white farmer. Quit. Leave me alone. And he had this bullshit, bullshit, bullshit farm and a rabbit. A rabbit came along and ate a couple of his, cabbages. You better kill me, because if you don't, when you're through, I'm going to kill you. Just a few cabbages, you know what I mean? I am going to kill you. Kill you. So he got this great idea about how to get him, how to trap this rabbit. And you know what he did? He made him a tar baby. He made it. You hear me? He made it. As sure as I live, she said, I'm going to kill you. But she didn't. After he banged the bedroom door, she lay in wrinkled sheets, slippery, gutted, not thinking of killing him. Thinking instead that it would soon be Thanksgiving and there was no place to go for dinner. Then she thought of a towering brass beech, the biggest and oldest in the state. It stood on the north side of the campus, and near it was a well. In April, the girls met their mothers there to sing and hold hands and sway in the afternoon light. Some of the girls hated it, the well, the beach, the mother-daughter day, and sat around in jeans and no shoes, smoking herb to show their contempt for bourgeoisie sentiment and alumni hustling. But the girls who did not hate it surrounded the beach and in long pastel skirts swayed in the spring light. Pale sulfur light sprinkled so softly with lilac, it made her want to cry. Jadine joined the barefoot ones, of course, but her tears were not because there was no one to sing with under the biggest beech in the state, but because of the light, pale sulfur sprinkled with lilac. A piece of her hair was in her mouth, and she tried to extricate it with her tongue, for her hands weighed a ton apiece. "This is familiar," she thought. "I know what this is. It's familiar. I am 25, and this feeling is too old for me." 4 hours later, he was back, repentant, terrified that he had gone too far. But Jadine was solemn, a closed-away orphan in a Cheech and Chong t-shirt with no place to go at Thanksgiving. Sun sat at the foot of the bed and covered his knees with his hands. Jadine spoke very quietly to him. "I can't let you hurt me again. You stay in that medieval slave basket if you want to. You will stay there by yourself. Don't ask me to do it with you. I won't. There is nothing any of us can do about the past but make our own lives better. That's all I've been trying to help you do. That is the only revenge for us to get over, way over. But no, you want to talk about white babies. You don't know how to forget the past and do better." His budding repentance decomposed into a steaming compost. If I wanted the editorial page of the Atlanta Constitution, I would have bought it. "With what?" Jadine's voice was slick with danger. "With the money you got from Valerian, the money you fucked your way across Europe for." "We'll buy it then. Here. Here it is." She picked her wallet up from the night table and opened it. "Here it is, your original dime, the one you cleaned sheephead for, right? The one you loved? The only one you loved. All you want in the money line. Take it. Now you know where it came from, your original dime. Some black woman like me fucked a white man for it and then gave it to Frisco, who made you work your ass off for it. That's your original dime." She threw it on the floor. "Pick it up." He stared at her. The Cheech and Chong t-shirt was up around her waist, and her nakedness below embarrassed him now. He had produced that nakedness, and having soiled it, it shamed him. "Pick it up." She said it again and didn't even sit up. She just lay there, stroking her raw silk thighs the color of natural honey. There was sealskin in her eyes, and the ladies minding the pie table vanished like shadows under a noon gold sun. He thought it would be hard to do, but it wasn't. He thought it would be cold, too, cold and hard. But it wasn't. It was warm, almost soft, and quite round. He put it in his pocket, and having no place to put himself, left the apartment again. He came back the next night to empty rooms and a door key for each of the several locks. He sat down on the sofa and looked at the keys. A pile of mail was on the coffee table, too, and in it a heavy yellow envelope. He stared at it a while and then opened it. Out came the photo she had taken in the middle of the road in Elo. Beatrice, pretty Beatrice, soldier's daughter. She looked stupid. Ellen, sweet cookie-faced Ellen, the one he always thought so pretty. She looked stupid. They all looked stupid, backwoodsy, dumb, dead. Sun put down the photos. I have to find her, he thought. Whatever she wants, I have to do it. Want it. But first, I have to find her.
Context of White Supremacy. That is our first audio segment. End of chapter 9. We'll pick up the second audio segment, beginning of chapter 10. If you have thoughts, questions, things that stood out, feel free to share. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Quickly, before get to the folks who dialed in, I read or found a report, Child Abuse and Toni Morrison's Fiction, by R.M. Prabha, P-R-A-B-H-A. I think this is a non-white person. I could be in error, but I'm going to see if I can get in contact, because they have contact information, and maybe she'll come hang out. We can do some discussing of Tar Baby. She looks at a number of Toni Morrison's novels. I am not a literary scholar, and I am not a Toni Morrison scholar, but I have read a few of her books, and we've read two now on the book club, Bluest Eye and now Tar Baby. And she discusses those two books in her report, as well as Beloved and some of the other books. I didn't know how consistent a theme child abuse is in the work of Toni Morrison, but I know from Beloved, Pecola is raped by her father, Kali. And she, in addition to that, Kali is fighting. There's all this domestic abuse in the residence that the children are subjected to. So that is a substantial theme in The Bluest Eye. And then Beloved, you have the enslaved black female who kills her child so that the child won't be enslaved. I mean, it's a major theme throughout the work of Toni Morrison. And so I check out this report to see how Tar Baby, what she has to say about this particular book. She writes, so she breaks it up into different components. So the second component she writes about child abuse is physical abuse. She writes in the novel Tar Baby by Toni Morrison, Margaret, a young mother, abuses her child physically. She burns her son as an infant with cigarette tips and pricks him with pins. Margaret's maternal shortcomings are only hinted at during the course of the novel. Morrison says, when he was an infant, he seemed to want everything of her, and she did not know what to give. She loved him. Even then, no one would believe it. They would think she was one of those mothers in the National Enquirer, Tar Baby, page 58. At the heart of Margaret's problems are issues of society and status, as she would appear to be the embodiment of what women should want to be, but she is self-destructive. Margaret loses a sense of herself as she struggles to fit into an upper class that she is not born into, and she is constantly defeated because of her family's lack of contribution to her development and her husband's constant criticism. She is treated as an object because of her beauty. For Margaret, nothing could really explain her weird behaviors when she was young. Certainly as a young woman, she was deeply unhappy, married to a man much older than she, and living in a place far from home where she did not fit in. She felt bored and probably hopeless without anything meaningful in her life. What caused her to take out her frustrations in such a horrendous way, however, must remain a mystery. A mother who deliberately harms her own child while convincing herself that she did not suffer, that he did not suffer much, needs psychological help, which was something isolated on the Isle de Chavez and never had any hope of receiving. I'm skipping down just to get to one I thought was one of the more important points in the report. you just kind of heard some of her assessment of Margaret's situation and maybe why she did some of this. And poor old Margaret, she's with this older white dude and she's down here in the Caribbean away from New England and her family and friends and isolated. And she's a mom. She was even saying some of this to Undine last week, like, you know, why didn't you intervene? Why wouldn't you, the helpful mammy, to come in? You know, you're all old. And then Undine is like, I was the same age as you. What are you talking about? Anyway, skipping to the bottom, or closer to the conclusion of the report, it reads, the character of the perpetrators of child abuse also varies from each other. There are five known risk factors in families prone for child abuse. They are domestic violence, drug abuse, mental illness, lack of parenting skills, and stress. It is only Margaret and Tarbaby who must have had a mental illness for her to periodically abuse her child physically. The other mothers, who I believe are all black, who abused and neglected their children, were all mentally stable. And that really leaped out at me as I was reading the report, because, I mean, even from the bluest eye, I don't think any of the black characters would qualify for mental health. I think we had a guest on the program who was known for saying no victim of white supremacy, certainly no one black, qualifies for mental health. If that is the case, then certainly none of the black characters. If you've got a black mom who is enslaved, being tortured and terrorized and doesn't know what to do, you know, with herself or how to save her child, you are suffering from mental illness. Certainly any of the black characters, male, female, parent, or no, there's no way. The bluest eye, you're walking around, man, I've got to have, you are suffering from mental illness. And I just, that, it astounded me to read this, and it almost seemed as though it was making excuses for my, how is it that it's only the white, how is it it's only Margaret out of all the characters that Toni Morrison writes about? All the parents who engage in physical abuse, males and females, mothers and fathers, why is it that it's only the white woman who is, you know, she is not mentally stable. She had problems of her own. She was a victim herself, and that produced her abhorrent behavior. Why is it only she that gets a valid excuse? Just thought I would share that. In addition to what I said before, Beloved, I think it all relates, Beloved, which is mentioned in this report, made it into a big movie. Oprah Winfrey, Danny Glover, enslaved Negroes killing their children. Oh, let's have that on the big screen. Beautiful. Let's have it come out for Christmas, in fact. May have. Tarbaby, as I've been saying, is allegedly one of her least popular books, if not the least popular. They don't have a movie of Tarbaby. I haven't seen any talks about who they want, you know, to be in that film. Get Michael B. Jordan to be son. I haven't heard anything of that. If you have, let me know. Stark contrast, portraying white people as racist and child abusers, as opposed to having that all be on black people and what people are comfortable, even non-white people, because I think the author of this report is a non-white person. How comfortable even are we with talking about the brutality of white people without excusing their behavior? We'll get to the caller, *61, if you have thoughts on chapter 9 that we just finished up and or the report. I can share links if you all want to read, because, like I said, she talks about Tarbaby. She has a lot to say about Margaret, and she talks about some of the other books. People who were with us for The Bluest Eye might find it interesting. If you want to check it out, let me know, and I would be happy to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Well, the switchboard is being a little uncooperative, so give me a moment and I'll work to get the lines open. That was a little wacky. Let's see. We'll try again. It's been doing that for a good chunk of the day. I think even when I attempted to play the audio segment, it was took a little bit of time for some reason. All right, let's try again. See if, bang. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have questions, comments you would like to share? You should be with us, sir.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Jeff. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I'd like to start out saying that words are important. In the last reading and in the future, they are referring to, I guess, a replacement for yard man as a mulatto. And in the word guide, Mr. Fulham's word guide, mulatto is a word that should not be used. And the basic effect of the use of words like half white, mixed race, part white, serves no constructive purpose except to cause confusion, conflict, and hostility. So I was enlightened to find out that Miss Sally Brown was Cheyenne's mother. And so she's sleeping with a shotgun every night, although she goes to church and stays in church all day. And we felt at that time that, you know, it seemed to conflict with Christian belief. But she's Cheyenne's mother, and she wants revenge for her daughter. She's sleeping with this shotgun because she's probably going to blow Sean's head off the first time she sees it. And this, too, is in contrast with Christian belief. But Sean's father, on the other hand, was talking about how she slept with the gun, and he was more afraid of her than the law. And I got to thinking, and when the father told Son that Miss Sally Brown was dead, he asked about the boy, and the father said that the boy left, you know, with his family because he couldn't stay around there looking like that. He didn't have any eyebrows. And then the guy says, did he have any eyebrows? The guy said, I didn't see any eyebrows. All I saw was his head. So, and I should have took a razor to him. You know, and I was confused about all this talk, and I'm wondering, what are they talking about? And so I guess the boy was the young man or the teenager that was in the house when it caught fire. And so he was burnt, his eyebrows were gone, and probably he was disfigured, and he moved on. So that's when I came to the conclusion that Miss Sally Brown was Cheyenne's mother. And I noticed that the characters in this book do not take responsibility for their actions. In other words, okay, Son was gone for 8 years. He comes back. His father, we know, had been aiding and abetting him. He's a fugitive on the run. But then when he shows back up after 8 years, he's got a girl with him. He don't want him to stay in his house because of his beliefs, but he has no sympathy for the victim, the family of the victims. It's the girl is dead. The boy is seriously injured. That I don't see any, sympathetic gestures or any mention of it. It's just, and I suspect that him not wanting Son and the girl to stay at his house was giving Son an excuse to maybe carouse a little bit, you know, during the late hours with Jay Dean over at Aunt Rose. But needless to say, it still looks suspicious because when they went out to the club, he allowed Jay Dean to indulge in alcohol a little bit too much. Sounds like she, you know, besides having too much to drink, she may have had a Mickey slipped in her drink. She passes out, takes old Aunt Rosa, and he's got the rest of the night. So I think it was a little something more than what meets the eye there. But when we find out more of the characters, Francine, son's sister, attacked by dogs and ran crazy. I guess some officers were looking for an escape convict, and the dogs attacked her. But when son was describing it, it sounded as if he made Francine sound like it was her fault. He said on page 268 that he couldn't understand that, okay, before Francine was attacked by the dog, she gave him 10 points on the court and still beat him. It was her athletic skill that caused her trouble. She was running in the field and went too far. Some dogs tracked in an escaped convict, frustrated at having lost the scent, attacked her. 60 seconds later, the police pulled them off of her and took her home. Now, if you think about that, if you're working with dogs, dogs have a command. And if they are doing something that the owners don't like, they give this command, it wouldn't take 60 seconds of a vicious dog attack before they pull them off of them without giving the command. So I find that kind of suspicious. And it destroyed Francine's life. She was nervous, couldn't get it together, and pulled her hair out and spent the remainder of her years in a mental institution. But I think he missed a point here also when she was talking about equality and sexual equality and all that, and he started discussing the women in his life. You know, Francine could spot him in basketball, or Cheyenne could, she could shift an old truck and put down a pheasant like the Indian. His mother could rope horses, and his grandmother built a cow shed. And Rosa helped her, and I guess the room that Francine was living in, Rosa had built that and left out the windows. You know, I mean, but what he's saying is things that are physical, things that women can do in a physical sense, but it misses the point that she's trying to make. He can't see his deficiency, you know, when he looks at women as objects. And I thought it was interesting too that both of them thought that they was rescuing each other. She thought she was rescuing him from the night women, and there's some mention of a cradle in here, so we know that in a system of white supremacy, black men and women are not looked at as adults. And he thought that he was rescuing her from Valerian, or the books say them, which I think they're referring to white people. Whereas in a mere 300 years, they kill a world million years old and destroyed the coastlines and their own hills and forests, and even some of them built something nice and human. They grew vicious, protecting it from their predatory children, let alone an outsider. To me, that sounds like an indictment on white people. I could be mistaken. And she referred to Edo as a medieval slave basket. I thought that was disrespectful. You know, that's where the man come from. And she didn't want to stay there, and she took off. And they said some pretty mean things to each other, and they got into a fight. And, you know, I think this is the first time that they realized that they're from two different worlds. And although I think the phrase, you can never go home again, is applicable here, because things change and the place change, but also the people change. And when they come back, they're not the same person they were when they left. So you're not going to get the same feeling of being home again. And they're from two different worlds. And I don't think Jadeen really has a place that she calls her own. And one last thing on page 262, it's a quote that I like. She said that it was when she was having a dream, and she was dreaming of the woman in the yellow dress, and her arm stretched 12 feet, 15 towards her, and her fingers were fingering eggs. And the next part said, it hurt. And part of the hurt was in having the vision at all, that being the helpless victim of a dream that chose you. Some was a funnel sorrow of being publicly humiliated by those you have loved or thought kindly toward. A little bitter hurt that was always gleaming when you looked at it. So you covered it over with a lid until the next time. But most of the hurt was dread. I think that was pretty profound, and it's applicable here, because in several of the instances, and you can apply it in the different relationships. I'll leave my line at this time. I have a few more notes, but I'll reserve it for a little later. Thanks, Chuck.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Let's see, Henry in Chicago should be with us as well. If you have commentary, proceed, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and the listeners. But before I get into my commentary, I know in the beginning of the show you're talking about how this Toni Morrison book is like the least studied academically. And I thought that was pretty interesting too, because, you know, during my years in school, I remember seeing like The Bluest Eye and Beloved, and I believe Song of Solomon as well. But yeah, Tar Baby was never a Toni Morrison book that I saw through my academic years. On page 257, there was a quote here that says, can't we be gentle first and honest later? I don't know why I underlined that, but I thought it was pretty interesting. What does that mean about I don't even know if this is Jadeen or this is Sun. Okay, I have to get back to that one. But I thought that was pretty interesting. On the next page, when Jadeen had that vision or dream, and she was talking about the yellow woman who did something more shocking, because I think everybody was, all the women were exposing their breasts to her. But she was shocked by the woman in yellow, where she stretched out her arm and showed Jadeen three big eggs. And I believe that symbolizes fertility. And the breast, I know you talked about this last week in regards to black mothers forcing to take care of white babies. And I know they used to breastfeed the, you know, the white babies. So I'm thinking that might have something to do with that, that vision that Jadeen had in that room. When Son and Jadeen basically were arguing about college, I think this started on page 262, 263, you know, the system of white supremacy has gotten, like, I was really confused on this because, you know, obviously Jadeen was, you know, very trusting of the, you know, of the white institutional education, and Son was basically kind of totally against it. And I mean, I myself, looking at it, yes, there is a thing in education where they kind of conform you to the system of white supremacy. But, you know, we have to, you know, as people, we have to kind of take whatever information we can get from, you know, from white people and use it to replace the system of white supremacy with justice. I'm not going to say that education is totally useless, but at the same time, it can be used in some way. We just have to get into a codified mindset in trying to use that information against, you know, against this white supremacist system. But obviously, the system of white supremacy has us thinking that either, you know, either we have to be educated or we shouldn't be educated at all. But I think there's something in the middle where we can use that education to, you know, bring down the system and replace it with justice. On 263, there's a paragraph here where she, on the line she said, she fought him but never mentioned the night women. They fought instead about Valerian Street. I thought that was very interesting because obviously we fight each other as non-white black people, you know, because white people have convinced us that we are each other's enemy. And obviously they're both fighting about Valerian, how, you know, how bad Valerian is or how great Valerian is. And, you know, it basically, he's the cause of all this, you know, commotion that's going on between Jadeen and Son. And it's also interesting with this conflict that they're having, how much they're kind of mirroring what Valerian and Margaret's relationship is, because even though I can't remember, but they weren't physically violent with each other, but they were both verbally violent with each other. And it seems like Jadeen and Son is kind of taking on that same trait, but then adding kind of like a physical, you know, physical aggression, you know, towards it. But obviously, like I said, you know, all because of Valerian. Valerian, you know, is the source of all that, you know, aggression and confusion that's going on between them. You have Jadeen just insisting about, you know, Valerian educating, you know, educating her. And I'm not sure, but Valerian was not a professor or teacher, so that was kind of weird how she was saying that. And Son was basically telling her that, yeah, Valerian didn't educate you. The part where they were talking about making it in New York and not making it in New York. And I thought that was interesting how, you know, we as black people kind of fight over what's the best plantation in the country. I know, you know, you always say that Seattle, your place, is the best plantation. I would say Chicago is the best plantation. But then again, you know, I'm starting to not think of that anymore. But yeah, it's basically, you know, once again, the system has us fighting over something that, we necessarily don't even own. It was interesting when Jadine was talking about, I pay the bills is what I do. And it's kind of common in black and non-white black marriages where, you know, it's we try to take on the so-called patriarchy type of, you know, white family structure where the man has to take care of everything. And instead of just, you know, it being a marriage and being a common thing where both partners take care of the family, obviously, you know, we can't be patriarchs. We can't even be matriarchs in the system of white supremacy. We talked about that before, so I don't know why we tried to take on that role. And I guess Jadine was kind of upset about her paying the bills since, you know, he's supposed to be the man and pays all the bills, but obviously, you know, in the system of white supremacy, he's technically not a man. On that same page where they were talking about in Europe, they liked older looking black models, but in the U.S., the look was 12. That sounds like pedophilia to me. Jeff Epstein, Jerry Sandusky, you know, that type of white pedophilia where they love the little black girls and, you know, put them in this child prostitution ring that they're coming up with. Francine attacked by dogs. White people love to use dogs against non-white people, especially black people. Civil rights movement, South Africa, all of the colonized African nations, dogs was one of the main weapons against black people. Let's see. I think I had, okay. That's it for now. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. Whew, I have been to the Windy City a few times. On nary a visit did I think, wow, this is the best plantation. In fact, I remember when I went there, I think was that the first time? I think it was the first time I went to Chicago. We were outside. It was after 10 o'clock, and we hit one of the areas where they stockpile the Negras in Chicago, and wow, I am not a tough person at all. That is one time I will freely admit we were there and I thought, wow, I'm going to pray really hard that nothing happens to this vehicle because it looks like we would be in danger. And I do not feel bad about that at all because I talked to Mr. Fuller and he was talking about Chicago and he had a story that was exactly the same. He said he was with Dr. Ben. They were at a stoplight and he thought, oh my Lord, I hope this car doesn't right now. No, we could. That is, woo, Chicago, my goodness. All right, so back to the book. That line, can we be gentle first and honest later, I thought was significant too. I'll have to ponder on that. I feel like Toni Morrison does that a lot. She'll have lines that, you know, you'll have to ponder on a bit, maybe even borrow later on, but just the context of when that is said. So this is Jadine's son. They're together. They're still in Elo. Son says, leave the back door open. I'll come in and stay with you all night. And in the morning, I'll go around the front like I just got there. You promise? I promise. This is Jadine. Paleolithic, she thought. I am stuck here with a pack of Neanderthals who think sex is dirty or strange or something. And he is standing here almost 30 years old doing it too. Stupid. Stupid, she said out loud. I know, but that's the way they are. What do you want me to do? You think anything we do is going to change them? I want us to be honest. Can we be gentle first and honest later? I guess I'll give my thoughts, but I'll pause. Henry in Chicago, any clarity hearing it again with that context, or you want to take a little more time to ponder?
Give me a little bit more time.
Always allowed. So going back over, and Mr. Demery IV thought that was an extraordinarily important point about both Sun and Jadine viewing this arrangement as a rescue. And they both use that word specifically at different points in the book. That's the thought process that they have about that, about this, like I said, arrangement, is that this is a rescue. Sun rescuing her from, I guess, her white validation and connection with white folks and what she's doing. And she rescuing him from his love of ignorance and sloth and, you know, uncivilized, wild behavior. But that is a disastrous sign, some sort of relationship starting out where everybody views this as a rescue, or anybody really views this as some sort of rescue or humanitarian effort with this arrangement. Let's see. I thought Ela would be disastrous. I didn't think she would enjoy it. I didn't think there would be anything enjoyable about it. I don't know why he has a fascination with this place. I guess I'll ponder on that as we get ready to wrap the book up next week. But it just can't be anything to be proud about in a little area like this where white people control if you're going to have water or mail. So I was not surprised that things went bad quickly with this whole trip. Let's see. I thought, talking about objectification, the line where they sat back and enjoyed his presence and his prize woman, talking about the black people in Ela looking at Sun. They looked at him with love and looked at her like she was a Cadillac he had won or stolen or even bought for all they knew. Wow. just wow. Degrading on all accounts, both she being objectified and compared to a car, and then he, you know, maybe he stole her, maybe he paid for her, like, who knows? And all of this whole scene when they're talking about the ladies crowding around and wanting to ask Jadine where she got her shoes from and how much they cost and all of this, it reminded me a little bit of The Warmth of Other Suns when some of the black people would leave the South and then come back to show off all that they had. I think Mr. Fuller talked about this. You leave and then come back with all your suits and your fancy car. And it's, oh, my God, look at this. He came back from Chicago. And that was a bit frequent one, coming back from Chicago. And look at all the fancy threads and everything else. But that line stuck out specifically in that whole scene. Seemed very reminiscent. Isabel Wilkerson. Next. Oh, man, yeah. The major scenes, recurring arguments that they have about Valerian. I thought that was important, too, that they are always fighting about Valerian, who is not even on the same continent as them, but they're fighting about him. Let's see. When Sun says, oh, wait a minute, let me give the whole line. Sun said, no way, I am not about to sit here and argue about that white man. Who cares what color he is? Uh-oh. A non-white person, victim, who makes a statement like that, I would think, wow. We're not, talk about being honest with each other, like in a system of white supremacy to even make a statement like that, there has to be a high level of confusion. Continuing, I care and he cares. He cares what color he is, absolutely. He's a person, not a white man. That's not even a true statement. He put me through school. You have told me that a million times. Why not educate you? You did what you were told, didn't you? Ondine and Sydney were obedient, weren't they? White people love obedience, love it. Did he do anything hard for you? Did he give up anything important for you? That very important series of questions. And even he does slip in a few statements about the obedience. That's why I said, I think, wow, Toni Morrison is making some really substantial critiques of individuals classified as white and how they mistreat, abuse black people. And I think this is a huge one because I think so frequently it's Donald Sterling Donald Sterling gave the NAACP $5 million before, you know, the whole tape thing came out, recording of his comments about black people. But it's easy in a system of white supremacy for racists to give out gifts, all kinds of gifts. And I love that Sun, in addition, points out, hey, if Valerian was such a cool white man, in addition to paying for your schooling, which I think Sidney and Andina contributed to as well. And he says, hey, they're the ones who paid for your school, not, you know, this white man. If it wasn't for them, none of this would be happening. Why not put them in a house? Why not really hook them up? Why not just, oh, yeah, put a few of your coins in Social Security so you have a little pension when you're old and feeble? Why not, hey, let me get you a house? Why not, hey, let me hook you up so you can, you know, take care of your wife, let her retire, her feed her. I love that he points all of that out. These are black people that you are supposed to care about. These are your parents, ostensibly. Why not more concern for them and seeing how Valerian is not even doing as much as he could there? That's the thing. White people could end the system of white supremacy. They could, I mean, whatever little crumbs that they dole out, $5 million literally is crumbs for Donald Sterling and a substantial number of other white people. They could end the system. They don't want to. They like things as they are. Continuing. Great statement. I found myself in more alignment with more of the things that Sun was saying. But I do think Jadine has some valid points as well. They're those victims. Stop loving your ignorance. System of white supremacy, I think it diseducation is one of the terms that's been used before Dr. Baruti on this broadcast, how this system can really, with their racist education system and everything else, they can really get victims to a point where we are just not motivated to learn. We're not curious about the world. That is extremely important. Really be curious, be excited to learn. They also make it so that frequently we learn things that we are not able to apply in a beneficial manner. It certainly can discourage you from wanting to learn things. You feel like you learn something, then you're not able to apply it in or being compensated for your expertise, which is system of white supremacy. I love that he continues to, his name is not Yardman, it's Gideon, and actually calling black people by their proper titles, I think is so important. Let's see, a great point, Henry in Chicago, when she points out when she was getting quote unquote old, that in the U.S. the look was 12. That is Jerry Epstein. Excellent point. Let's see. When Son, Cheyenne, talk about child abuse. Mr. Demery Ford was talking about, you know, kind of connecting and getting, oh, okay, the child that's being talked about or the young boy that's being talked about, no eyebrows and all. Okay, he was in bed with Cheyenne when the fire happened. Got it. That's child abuse, too. When we talk about that theme, like I kind of putting it all together and seeing it, because this is a young boy, that's the man not talking about how a lot of times young black males are having these sexual experiences with females that are substantially older than they are, that are even older, 18, where this is statutory rape. That's what we're talking about. That's why I said this is child abuse too, a crime actually, that is taking place with this young boy here. But that's just kind of bad. I guess I would say that's the layers of Toni Morrison to say, wow, child abuse is that much of a theme. I think even one of her last books is called God Bless the Child. And that book, too, is all about child abuse. It happens repeatedly. But I mean, it's layers of child abuse and sexual abuse in there coming up for both black boys and black girls being subjected to this. Anyway, when Son gets into his whole passage where he says, you know, Jadine is always getting on me about, you know, sexual equality and me thinking that females are inferior. I thought that was a great point Mr. Demery Ford made about these are physical attributes that Son is pointing out. Francine being athletic and being able to beat him at basketball, and Rosa, she, you know, is a great carpenter and able to do all of these spectacular things. It did seem like there was something more, and him talking about the black females in general in ELO and the amount of power that they had. It did seem like there was something beyond, but that is completely accurate. He does mention strictly physical attributes, although I'm not sure what else he could have mentioned, because the black males aren't in charge either. They aren't the ones who are, you know, running the town. White people are. He said that before, like they are the ones that run the mail and the water and everything else. That's not black males that are in charge of that. Anyway, when he brings in that story, and I mean the brilliance of Toni Morrison to bring in this story, and at this point, this is where we can deviate and give a little more information about Francine, that, oh, I didn't think Francine was inferior. Look at how athletic she was. She used to stomp me playing basketball. In fact, boop, and then you can just sidebar in racism, white supremacy, and that's legend, black people being abused by dogs. And in 60 seconds, that's a long time to be mauled. And I mean, this is not ancient history. This is in the frickin' Ferguson report that just came out 2014. Or 2015, I guess, by the time the report was published, but with Michael Brown Jr. being killed, where they talked, that was one of the main things in the report. That stood out, in fact. I remember that was one of the things that I highlighted, the number of times that they had black children, I believe it was black boys exclusively, who Ferguson attack dogs, Ferguson police dogs chomped on them, truancy a lot of times, simple things, minor things, and they chomped on them. I don't know if it was 60 seconds, but 21st century, this is not fiction. Let's see. But I thought that was super, super important. It even reminded me of White Dog, where white people would train dogs to attack black people. One of the best films that I've seen about racism, White Dog, came out in the 80s. Let's see. I thought the violence of their disputes, it wouldn't just be an argument, but it would become so violently aggressive and threats to kill and to not, like, just wow, the anti-blackness. And this is a lot of times what happens in the system of white supremacy, all of the pressure that can be brought to bear. He's not able to function as a male. Even our ideas about how we're supposed to function, I thought that was a great point that was made earlier, thinking that it's supposed to be the way that white people have told us a quote unquote family is supposed to look like, and then getting frustrated with each other when we can't do that because we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. You're not able to be a man. I'm not able to be a woman. The only reason that she's able to do a lot of these things is because she has this white man, Valerian, who is there, you know, doing this and doing that to help her get this and help her get that, putting her in these better situations. These opportunities are not available to him. He's struggling to get what they called last week brute work. Flagrantly on display. That's not an accident. And them having all of these problems and strife and the bitterness that, you know, is in their arrangement, that is so very common in the system of racism, white supremacy. We're just not recognizing the problem. Not that having an understanding of racism, white supremacy stops these types of things. It does not, but it can help. I think it can help mitigate. I think if you have a better grasp of why the frustration is there, why it's so difficult for him to get a job, why he might not even be interested in doing the school is can be spectacular. But I think that even certainly with the admissions scandal that's going on and all the cheating, I certainly know that there are a lot of reports even talking about, hey, there are a lot of black people that have these degrees and have done a lot of schoolwork and have not, just what I said earlier, not compensated well at all. They get all that education and all of that scholarly material, and whites still treat them like a nigger. That is very, very common. So again, I can grasp why someone would be discouraged or unwilling to even venture into that environment. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get to? Oh, the Br'er Rabbit. Now, we had it brought up explicitly when they're having this big argument that looks, well, Matt, I don't know if it's going to end this permanently, but pretty big dispute here. And it seems like he's comparing her to the Tar Baby. I thought that was very important. I think that was something that was mentioned last week. Is every character in the book representative of the Tar Baby to some degree or not? I said, Toni Morrison, she said that Jadeen is the Tar Baby. This is at least the second time in the book that it seems someone is making a direct reference, either calling her the Tar Baby and or using a metaphor, bringing up this story where it seems like, or I guess I'll ask this, what did you all make of that when they have this big argument at the end? And Sun says, once upon a time, there was a farmer, a white farmer, quit, leave me alone. And he had this bullshit farm and a rabbit. A rabbit came along and ate a couple of his, cabbages. You better kill me, because if you don't, when you're through, I'm going to kill you. Just a few cabbages. You know what I mean? I'm going to kill you. Kill you. She got this great idea about how to get him. So how to trap this rabbit. And you know how what he did? He made a tar baby. He made it. You hear me? He made it. What do you all make of that? It seems, well, I won't even answer. What do you all make of this and why he would bring this up at this particular point? This is like huge, huge moment in a novel named Tar Baby. Yes. What do you all make of this segment and why he would bring up this fable at this point of their dispute?
You know, I would like to say that I thought about that. And if you look at it from the big picture, the white farmer representing, you know, the power structure and the system. And if they elevate the tar baby, which would be the black female, then you can catch the rabbit, which would be the black male. And so you could effectively, you know, cause disunity by just that, you know, using the black female to actually to do some harm towards the black male. And even in this relationship, Sun and JD, I thought about Pam's book, Black Love would have been a revolutionary act if they could have gotten it together and been able to help support and guide each other. So that's my take on it. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery. We'll pause right here, give everybody a chance to answer that question after we finish the second audio segment, just because it's a little lengthy. We are going to finish Chapter 10, and then we'll end the book next week. So this is Chapter 10, Toni Morrison, The Great Tar Baby, published in 1981, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Chapter 10. After 30 years of shame, the champion daisy trees were marshaling for war. The wild parrots that had escaped the guns of Dominique could feel menace in the creeping of their roots. During the day, they tossed their branches. At night, they walked the hills. At dawn, their new formations challenged the wit of the chevaliers. Their brothers, over on Dominique, knew nothing of the battle plans, for they were in a rainforest tamed for tourists that came by bus from the Old Queen Hotel, gallant and royal since 1927. Now she was dying from behind. Her front on Rue Madeleine was still sea-cap white, and the columns at her entrance showed no signs of wear. Yet at her great round-skirted rear, among breadfruit trees and lime, the cells of a motel were growing. A concrete Y-shaped thing with patios the size of a card table extended from the dining room, from whose 47 windows diners once gazed at breadfruit trees and lawn. Now they looked at workmen, concrete and patios the size of a card table. Beyond that were the hills of Black Dominiques, and beyond that, spectacular mountains of rainforest. The road that cuts through the mountains is a regular tourist attraction, Breathlessly steep and winding, without benefit of guardrails, it offers a view of God's hair, hibiscus, magnolia and oleander, poinsettia and jacaranda. Away in the distance, under pink immortelles, is an occasional dead plantation, now a hotel with marble dolphins and air conditioning pumping purity into 200-year-old stone. The mountain road descends on the other side of the island to a coastline of cliffs and grottos where fishing villages lay. No marinas here, no golf courses, for here the winds do not trade. They are hot and capricious, and the fishermen design strange sails to accommodate them so they can sell their grouper, tuna, and bonito to the dead plantations and the old Queen Hotel, where Jadine sat alone at a table for four. Crème de menthe, she had said, because the words seemed nice and right, and she wanted to say them aloud. And when the waiter returned, she regretted it immediately and ordered vermouth. She had called L'Arbre de la Croix. Ondine had answered, "Where are you?" "Queen of France, but I miss the ferry, Nanadine. Can somebody come?" "Well, yes, I reckon so, but it might take a while." "I'll wait. Tell him to come to the old queen. If I'm not in the lobby, ask for me in the dining room."
"You by yourself?"
"Of course. Hurry, please, Nanadine." "Of course I'm by myself. When haven't I been by myself?" She was alone at a table for four, proud of having been so decisive, so expert at the leaving, of having refused to be broken in the big, ugly hands of any man. Now she felt lean and male, having left quickly with no peeping back just in case, no explanatory loophole-laden note, no last supper. New York had agreed with her exit. A cab right at the door, an uncommunicative driver who took her directly to the place she was going to. Raymond, at home, his studio available for the night. A short line at Chemical Bank and Air France ready to go. Aloneness tasted good, and even at a table set for four, she was grateful to be far away from his original dime ways, his white folks, black folks primitivism. How could she make a life with a cultural throwback, she asked herself, and answered, "No way." Elo. No way. Not for all the cadmium yellow and Hansa red in the world. So what if she was all alone? So what if when she went away, no one stayed home and remained there all while she was gone and was waiting when she got back? But he had put his finger on the very bottom of her foot. He had opened the hair on her head with his hands and drove his tongue through the part. The mulatto didn't talk. He hummed a Creole hit and drummed a little on the steering wheel. As they passed Saint-Davier, Jadine's legs burned with the memory of tar. She could hardly see L'Arbre de la Croix when they got to it. The trees leaned so close to the house. She dashed into Ondine's kitchen, kissed her, and said, "Let me get my stuff together first. I'll be right back down, and we can talk. Is Margaret here?" "Upstairs," said Ondine. No one answered her knock at Margaret's door, but she saw a brighter-than-hallway light falling from Valerian's door and went toward it. Inside, heaped on the twin beds, on the dresser, the chairs, and even on the bed table, were clothes. Suits, ties, shirts, socks, sweaters, and pair after pair of men's shoes. "Valerian?" she called out. Margaret stepped from the closet dressing room, her hands full of empty hangers. "Well," she said, genuinely surprised, "the prodigal daughter. What did you do to your hair?" Margaret looked flushed and sparkly, her movements directed and sure. "Something different." "It's wonderful looking," said Margaret, coming toward her, hand outstretched to touch Jadine's hair. Then she stopped and snapped her fingers twice. We used to call it, oh dear. She closed her eyes. Poodle cut. That's it. Poodle cut. And she laughed with such pleasure that Jadine had to smile. I'm sorry about leaving you with so little notice. I don't want you to think I didn't appreciate your helping me out last winter. Margaret waved her hand. Don't mention it. It was a lousy time for everybody. She sat down on a cluttered bed and began to unbunch the hangers. Are you all leaving? Asked Jadine. Leaving? No. Why? Jadine looked at the clothes. Oh, no. I'm just straightening out this unbelievable mess. You wouldn't believe the things that man has accumulated. 8 shoe trees in his closet and only 2 of them actually in shoes. And look, linen slacks. Linen. Never worn and so yellow now they can't be. I never knew what a clothes horse the man was. See here? Margaret fingered the garment label. Silk. And here, virgin wool. Look here, 100% cotton. All his undershirts, too. He won't wear nylon or tricot. None of the man-made fibers. Everything he owns has to be made by Mother Nature. But what a mess. It'll take me days to get it all sorted. I can't expect Sidney to do this. It's not his job, really. Ondine's either. I really could use you now, Jade, but I don't suppose you're staying. No, I'm going back tomorrow. France? Yes. Will you marry that fellow, Mr. Sealskin? Jadine sighed. No. Oh? Why not? Margaret folded the slacks over padded hangers and laid them carefully on the bed. Now she was sorting shirts, smelling them for mildew, examining them for tears, missing buttons, frayed collars. She didn't seem interested in an answer to her question, so Jadine didn't give her one, didn't tell her that she hardly knew what the word meant. Instead, she asked how Valerian was. Better, said Margaret. He's not sick, is he? Asked Jadine. He says he isn't, but he trembles sometimes and won't go into town to see a doctor. This is no place to be sick in, Margaret. Maybe you should get him back to Philadelphia. Of course I will, if it gets really bad. She looked at Jadine as though hurt that her judgment about what was best for her husband was doubted. And Michael, how is he? Oh, you don't know, do you? He got in. Berkeley, I mean. The semester begins next week. Then you're not going out there? Oh, no. Michael's an adult, Jade. 30. I can't go traipsing around the world looking after him when there's so much to do here. You see the mess these clothes are in. She had finished separating the shirts into 3 piles and had begun on the sweaters. Jade, she said. She held a blue V-necked sweater to her chest. It was nothing like the blue of her eyes. Sometimes in the morning he can't do everything he used to. You know, buttons, zippers. I have to tie his shoes even. Yesterday I washed his hair, she smiled, with Kirk's original Castile soap. He doesn't like Breck. Jadine stared. Sidney's going to teach me how to shave him, and maybe together we can get him to let us cut his hair. God, is he stubborn. Worse than a child. She laughed lightly, indulgently, and went on sorting, piling like a confident curator who knew the names of everything in his museum, while Jadine watched, saying to herself, and he thinks Valerian made me. Ondine picked up a screaming lobster and threw him into a pot of boiling water. She held it down with a wooden ladle to make it die faster, for she was in the mood for death. It had been an hour since Jadine had come in and kissed her, all smiles and speed. Ondine didn't like her new hairdo. Fluffy. Frothy, as though it was important to look like a schoolgirl. Now she was back in the kitchen looking subdued. What's come over Margaret? Asked Jadine.
She's working her butt off. Do her good. Him too. But she talks about Valerian like he was a patient or a baby. People do what they have to, I guess, and take payment where they can. What's she mad at him for? She's the one who stuck pins in her baby. Undine wiped sweat from her forehead with her free hand. She didn't stick pins in her baby. She stuck them in his baby. Her baby she loved. That's a description, maybe, but not a reason. He gave her everything she ever wanted. Remember that little triumph? And what about he kept her stupid, kept her idle? That always spells danger. Now she's the master, not him. Master, patient, baby, it don't matter. He's still the center of everything. Undine withdrew the lobster and got right down to it. You ran off with him, didn't you? It's over, Nana Dean. I don't know what got into me. You could have told us. Maybe, but everything was so messed up here. I mean, that was some Christmas. You still could have told us. Well, if it will make you any happier, it was a mistake. A mistake of the first order, believe me. You know, I never worked so hard in my life to keep something going. I'd never done that before. I never cared whether a relationship worked or not, you know? I mean, if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, later. But this time, I worked my butt off, and all I got for it was a black eye and the rent. So, Jadine slapped the table with her palm, marking the end of the affair. That's that. He hit you? Yes, among other things. He actually hit you? It's over, Nana Dean. Besides, I hit him too. I should hope so. I should damn well hope so. Oh, baby, baby, how could you run off with a... Let's don't talk about it. I left and that's that. One thing, though. If he calls here, you don't know where I am. And if he comes here... Comes here? Well, I don't know. He might. Anyhow, don't tell him where I am. Where are you? Asked Undine. I'm going to get my stuff and go back to Paris. Stuff, thought Undine, meant mainly the fur coat. She wondered if her niece would even have come to say goodbye had it not been that the sealskin coat was there. Then what? She asked. Jadine shrugged and changed the subject. How's Valerian? Hanging on. Did she really do all of that to her baby? She really did. Wow. And she's not bugging you anymore? Not at all. So what's your situation here? Jadine's voice was serious, but there was pleading in it too. Please don't need me now. Not now. I can't parent now. I cannot be needed now. Another time, please. I have spent it all. Please don't need me now. Same. They want us to stay. Mrs. Street does anyway. And he don't say much one way or the other. Sits in that greenhouse all day listening to music. Do you want to stay? Do we have a choice? Asked Undine, looking carefully at the ringlets on Jadine's head. Sure you have a choice. You can work other places or not at all. You want to come with me to Paris? Jadine's shoulder ached for a second as she remembered hanging out of a second-story window on 93rd Street. Girl, don't play with me. I'm serious. Jadine, we done what we could for you because, well, what I mean to say is you don't owe us nothing. But, well... I never told you nothing. I never told you nothing at all, and I take full responsibility for that. But I have to tell you something now. Jadine lifted her head and looked in her aunt's eyes. Jadine, a girl has got to be a daughter first. She have to learn that. And if she never learns how to be a daughter, she can't never learn how to be a woman. I mean a real woman. A woman good enough for a child. Good enough for a man. Good enough even for the respect of other women. Now, you didn't have a mother long enough to learn much about it,
and I thought I was doing right by sending you to all them schools, and so I never told you it, and I should have. You don't need your own natural mother to be a daughter. All you need is to feel a certain way, a certain careful way about people older than you are. Don't mistake me now. I don't mean you have to love all kinds of mean old people. And if it's in your mind that I'm begging you for something, get it out. I ain't. Yes, you are, Ondine. Jadine's voice was steady. You are asking me to parent you. Please don't. I can't do that now. I am not asking you that. I'm just saying what a daughter is. A daughter is a woman that cares about where she come from and takes care of them that took care of her. No, I don't want you to be what you call a parent. Not me, and not Sydney either. What I want from you is what I want for you. I don't want you to care about me for my sake. I want you to care about me for yours. She reached out to touch her niece's hand, but something made her stop short of it. When Ondine said, "You didn't have a mother long enough," blood rushed to Jadine's skin the way it always did when her motherlessness was mentioned. But she spoke gently and steadily to Ondine. "No, you don't, Nana Dean. You want me to pay you back. You worked for me and put up with me. Now it's my turn to do it for you. That's all you're saying." "Turn? Turn? This ain't no game of bid whist." "There are other ways to be a woman, Nana Dean," Jadine went on. "Your way is one. I guess it is, but it's not my way. I don't want to be like you." "Wait, don't look at me like that. I'm being honest with you now, and you have to listen. I don't want to learn how to be the kind of woman you're talking about, because I don't want to be that kind of woman." "There ain't but one kind, just one. And if you say another hateful word to me, I'll..." She stopped. "What? Hit me? Would you, Nana Dean? You'd hit me too?" The older woman was quiet. Her niece, her baby, her crown had put her in the same category as that thing she ran off with. And now she was going on talking, explaining, saying, but Ondine never heard anymore. The volume of her heart was up too loud. When Jadine went off to finish packing, Ondine sat patting the table with her right hand, her chin resting on the fist of her left. She didn't know what she expected, what she was expecting her niece to do or think or feel, but something more than she had seen. "Maybe she's right. Maybe I just wanted her to feel sorry for us," she thought. "Maybe that's what I expected, and that's a low-down wish if ever I had one." Sydney came in and stopped her thoughts. "That her?" he asked. "Yes." "Off again?" "Yep, Paris." "Where's he?" "She dumped him." "I could have told him that." "So could I." "Go up and say goodbye to her. She's making tracks tomorrow if she can." Sydney sat down and unclasped his bow tie. "She ask you for any money?" "Nothing dangerous, just a few francs for the shuttle. She had a thing full of those what you call traveling checks." "Go on up and see her. I'll take him his tray." "She wants to say goodbye. She knows where I am." "Sydney, don't be like that." "But I am like that. She didn't do well by us, Ondine." "She's young. She'll settle. Age ain't got nothing to do with it. She's not a savings account, Sydney. You don't get interest back." "Ought to. It's more different for them than it was for us. There's a whole bunch of stuff they can do that we never knew nothing about." "And a whole bunch they don't know nothing about," he answered. "Well, maybe you right. Maybe it don't pay to love nothing. I love that little boy like he was mine, so he wouldn't grow up and kill somebody. And instead of thanks, I get meanness, disrespect. Let's not go into that no more. He's okay now, doing fine. But I'm not responsible for that, no. I'm responsible for not telling nobody." She accused me of not liking her enough to stop her. You go figure that out. Then I take another one in my heart, your brother's baby girl, another one not from my womb, and I stand on my feet 30 years so she wouldn't have to, and did without so she wouldn't have to. And she couldn't think of nothing better to do than buy me some shoes I can't wear, a dress I shouldn't, and run off with the first pair of pants that steps in the door. Now explain me that. I can't explain nothing no more. It didn't used to be this way. Seemed like folks used to take care of folks once upon a time. Old black people must be a worrisome thing to the young ones these days. Undine went to the oven and removed a baked potato. She put it on a plate and the plate on a tray. Then she went to the refrigerator and removed a wine glass that had been chilling there. Sydney watched her movements. Undine got out a napkin. She said she didn't think he would, but if he did call or come looking for her, we shouldn't let him know where she is. He better not set foot on this place. From what she says, he beat her up some. Then I hope he does come, said Sydney. I'll put that bullet in him for sure. No, you won't. You mistake me if you don't think so. I'll shoot him the same minute I see him and explain later. This is not your property, Sydney. No, but it's my home. If this ain't my home, then nothing is but the grave. Well, we'll be there soon enough. Sydney thought about that. You think she'll bury us, Undine? I think we're going to have to bury ourselves, Sydney. Well, in that case, the shroud may as well be comfy. He picked up the rattan tray, and, since he was a genuine Philadelphia Negro mentioned in the book of that name, he reclasped his bow tie and adjusted his cufflinks before he left the kitchen and went to the greenhouse. He noticed that the bricks that edged the courtyard were popping up out of the ground, leaning every which way. Urged, it seemed to him, out of the earth, like they were poked from beneath. Cement, he thought, is all that will keep this earth still. This place dislocates everything. I'll get that mulatto to fix them right this time. And something serious had to be done about the ants. They had already eaten through the loudspeaker wires, and he had had to transfer the entire system to the greenhouse, turntable, receiver, records. Sydney was grateful to the ants because he really hated vacuuming or polishing doorknobs while the music boomed through the house. He preferred silence for his work. Now he was free of it, and Mr. Street had it all to himself. Still, if ants will eat copper, something serious had to be done. If it's not one thing, it's another, he thought, and either he was shrinking in his old age or the trees were jumping up overnight. The roof of the wash house was completely obscured by a heavy branch. That mulatto may buck if I tell him to cut it down, he thought. Better get somebody from town. The greenhouse was sunk in violins, and Valerian, seated at a seed bench, did not hear Sydney enter. He was drenched in music, and although his fingers shuddered occasionally, his head of a coin profile moved accurately to the tempo. Sydney tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned. Your lunch, Mr. Street. Valerian motioned for him to put the tray down, his fingers describing a wavy arc in the air. You letting this place run down, Mr. Street? What's that? Asked Valerian. Sydney walked over to the record player and lifted the arm away. I said you letting this place run down. Used to be pretty in here. You letting it go to pieces. It's my place, said Valerian. Turn the music back on. Sydney did not move, but said, You don't grow nothing in here anymore. I like it this way, Sydney. Put the music back. Then you should take care of it. That'll do, Sydney. Hand me the mail. Sydney picked up the stack of letters, circulars, and catalogs and held them out to Valerian, but the dancing hands could not receive them. Want me to open them for you? Asked Sydney. No. Yes. Sydney pulled up a stepping stool and sat down next to Valerian.
You should take care of yourself, too. You need a haircut.
I prefer it long, said Valerian.
No, you don't.
You just don't want to go into town. The mulatto's here today. If you won't let me cut it, let him take you over.
What mulatto?
Sydney slit open a letter with a penknife. The one Dr. Michelin sent over. A mulatto. Been coming a while now. He can take you over to get your hair cut.
Not today, said Valerian.
Not today. Later, Sydney.
Valerian turned toward the tray and tried to pick up the knife and fork. He succeeded, but could not manage to make them do anything else but wave there in his hands.
Sydney put aside the mail and stood up. He took the knife and fork from Valerian, broke open the steaming potato, and scooped out a forkful. He blew on it and then held it in front of Valerian's mouth. Valerian closed his lips and looked into Sydney's eyes. He tried as best he could to see what was there, what was really there. He wasn't sure, but he believed he saw kindness. He opened his lips and swallowed.
Good, said Sydney. That's good. It's not too hot, is it?
Valerian shook his head and opened his mouth for more. He chewed for a little while and then said,
Sydney?
Yes, sir.
Did you... No, sir, I didn't. I heard about it same time you did.
Undine never told you?
Not a word.
I hear them in the kitchen, talking like they used to.
Yes, sir.
Remember how they used to gossip in the kitchen back then?
I remember.
He's all right, isn't he?
Michael?
Oh, yes, sir, he's fine.
I'm thinking of going back. I think I should leave this place and go back to Philadelphia.
What for?
I don't like it here anymore. No reason to be here now.
No reason to be anywhere, Mr. Street. But I'd think carefully on it if I was you.
Undine and me, we like it down here. Philadelphia winters can be hard on old people. It's nice and warm down here. Quiet, too. We like it fine.
Would you like a sip of Chablis now?
He put down the fork and went to the small refrigerator for a bottle of wine.
No, said Valerian, not now.
I would, said Sydney. I'd like a glass myself.
He worked the screw into the cork.
You sure you don't want any?
I said no.
How are your bunions, Mr. Street?
Corns. I don't have bunions. I have corns.
How are they?
Sydney, you are drinking my wine.
Next time that mulatto comes, I'll tell him to bring you back a pair of hirachis.
I don't want any hirachis.
Sure you do. Nice pair of hirachis be good for you. Make your feet feel good. This time next year, you'll thank me for 'em.
What do you mean, this time next year?
I'm going back.
I figure we're going to be here a long time, Mr. Street. A good long time.
What's happening here?
Something's happening here.
Don't agitate yourself. Rest your mind.
Sydney put down the wine glass and went to the record player. He held the arm over the record and turned to Valerian.
We'll give you the best of care, just like we always done. That's something you ain't never got to worry about.
He placed the arm carefully in the groove and turned the volume up high. Valerian smiled then, and his fingers danced lightly in the air. The airport in Dominique is a long building made of pale yellow concrete blocks. If you didn't know you were in the Caribbean, the paper in the ladies' room would tell you. To an American, the contempt in which the rest of the world holds toilet paper is incomprehensible. It is treated as though it were, in fact, toilet paper. Jadine stepped out of the stall and stood before the tiny mirror over the sink. She sudsed her hands generously with a piece of her own soap and rinsed them carefully. She wrapped the soap in a piece of wax paper
returned it to her traveling bag, from which she took a tube of hand lotion. She creamed her palms and the backs of her hands, then, with tissue, wiped away the lotion that had gotten under her fingernails. Unhurried at last, with 30 minutes before flight time. The frantic scampering over with. She had run away from New York City with the same speed she had run toward it. New York was not her home after all. The dogs were leashed in the city, but the reins were not always secure. Sometimes, walking with their owners, they met other dogs, and if they were unspayed and unchecked, you could see a female standing quietly under the paws of a male who had not even spoken to her, just sniffed for purposes of identification. She thought it could be a shelter for her, because there the night women could be beaten, reduced to shadows and confined to the briar patch where they belonged. But she could not beat them alone. There were no shelters anyway. It was adolescent to think that there were. Every orphan knew that, and knew also that mothers, however beautiful, were not fair. No matter what you did, the diaspora mothers with pumping breasts would impugn your character. And an African woman, with a single glance from eyes that had burned away their own lashes, could discredit your elements. She still had plenty of time to take 2 Dramamines, comb her hair, check her makeup. But this lady's lounge was not designed for lingering. She was doing her eyes when a girl came out of the stall next to the one she had used. She had a short mop and a plastic pail of various cleansers in her hands. She wore a green uniform which looked even greener beneath her russet wig. Jadine glanced at the wig in the mirror and then back to her own lashes. The girl stopped dead and did not take her eyes off Jadine, who was flattered but wished she would not stare so. Then the girl approached her. "You don't remember me?" she asked. Jadine turned around. The wig was so overwhelming it was a while before she recognized her. "L'Arbre de la Croix," said the girl. "Oh, wow," Jadine smiled. "I didn't recognize you. What are you doing here? You work here now?" The girl nodded. "You took the chocolate eater away," she said. Jadine closed her smile and turned back to the mirror. There was nothing like an islander. They never had any chat or manners, for that matter. Conversation with them was always an interrogation, and she was not about to explain anything to this child. "He was going to send me a wig," he said. "Looks like he did," said Jadine. "Not this one. I have a picture of the other one. It's at home. Is he coming back? Can you get it for me?" "No," Jadine answered. "You kill him?" asked the girl in a very matter-of-fact tone. Jadine slung the huge, lightweight traveling bag over her shoulder and removed her coat from the top of the stall where it hung. "I have to go now," she said. "Therese said you kill him," the girl insisted. "Tell Therese she killed him." "No," said the girl, perplexed. "Therese has magic breasts. They still give milk." "I bet they do," said Jadine. "But there is nobody to nurse them." "She's not looking in the right places," said Jadine. Black pearls of hair were visible at the wig's edge. The girl's eyes were wide, still. The curiosity in them was the only thing that kept them from looking like an animal's. A deer, thought Jadine. She has the eyes of a curious deer. She wished once more that she had had real talent. She'd like to draw her, deer eyes, wig, and all. Suddenly, she reached into the side pocket of her traveling bag. A few francs were shoved in there, and she dropped the whole lot into the girl's plastic pail. "Bye, Mary. I have to go. Good luck." Jadine pushed open the door and was gone. "Alma," whispered the girl. "Alma Este." Aboard the 707, Jadine had free use of the seat next to her. Not many passengers in first class. She checked her 5 luggage claim tickets stapled to the envelope that held a copy of her one-way ticket to Orly. Everything was in order. As soon as the plane was airborne, she reached above her head to adjust the airflow. Bringing her hand down, she noticed a tiny irregularity in the nail of her forefinger. She opened her purse and took out an emery board. 2 swift strokes and it was gone. Her nail was perfect again. She turned her sealskin coat lining side out and folded it carefully into the empty seat beside her. Then she adjusted the headrest. The same 16 answers to the question, "What went wrong?" kicked like a chorus line. Having 16 answers meant having none. So none it was. 0. She would go back to Paris and begin at go. Let loose the dogs. Tangle with the woman in yellow. With her and with all the night women who had looked at her. No more shoulders and limitless chests. No more dreams of safety. No more. Perhaps that was the thing Ondine was saying. A grown woman did not need safety or its dreams. She was the safety she longed for. The plane lifted itself gracefully over the island, its tail of smoke widened, then dispersed. It was evening, and the stars were already brilliant. The hills below crouched on all 4 under the weight of the rainforest, where liana grew and soldier ants marched in formation. Straight ahead they marched, shamelessly, single-minded, for soldier ants have no time for dreaming. Almost all of them are women, and there is so much to do, the work is literally endless. So many to be born and fed, then found and buried. There is no time for dreaming. The life of their world requires organization so tight and sacrifice so complete, there is little need for males, and they are seldom produced. When they are needed, it is deliberately done by the queen, who surmises, by some 4-million-year-old magic she is heiress to, that it is time. So she urges a sperm from the private womb where they were placed when she had her 1 first and last copulation. Once in life, this little Amazon trembled in the air waiting for a male to mount her. And when he did, when he joined a cloud of others one evening just before a summer storm, joined colonies from all over the world gathered for the marriage flight, he knew at last what his wings were for. Frenzied, he flies into the humming cloud to fight gravity and time in order to do just once the single thing he was born for. Then he drops dead, having emptied his sperm into his lady love. Sperm which she keeps in a special place to use at her own discretion when there is need for another dark and singing cloud of ant folk mating in the air. Once the lady has collected the sperm, she too falls to the ground, but unless she breaks her back or neck or is eaten by one of 1,000 things, she staggers to her legs and looks for a stone to rub on, cracking and shredding the wings she will never need again. Then she begins her journey, searching for a suitable place to build her kingdom. She crawls into the hollow of a tree, examines its walls and corners. She seals herself off from all society and eats her own wing muscles until she bears her eggs. When the first larvae appear, there is nothing to feed them, so she gives them their unhatched sisters until they are old enough and strong enough to hunt and bring their prey back to the kingdom. That is all. Bearing, hunting, eating, fighting, burying. No time for dreaming, although sometimes, late in life, somewhere between the 30th and 40th generation, she might get wind of a summer storm one day. The scent of it will invade her palace, and she will recall the rush of wind on her belly, the stretch of fresh wings, the blinding anticipation, and herself there, airborne, suspended, open, trusting, frightened, determined, vulnerable, girlish even, for an entire second, and then another and another.
She may lift her head then and point her wands toward the place where the summer storm is entering her palace, and in the weariness that ruling queens alone know, she may wonder whether his death was sudden, or did he languish? And if so, if there was a bit of time left, did he think how mean the world was, or did he fill that space of time thinking of her? But soldier ants do not have time for dreaming. They are women and have much to do. Still, it would be hard. So very hard to forget the man who fucked like a star.
Context of white supremacy. I don't know how I feel about the end of chapter 10. Like, we just talked on the compensatory call-in. There was so much discussion about Amber Geiger and the courtroom scene last week. She's convicted, 10 years, and Botham Jean's, John's brother, gives her this hug in the courtroom. And I said on the compensatory call-in that I saw people who were voicing their displeasure about this and saying, oh my gosh, his brother was feverish. He wanted sexual intercourse with that white woman. That's what was happening. And I said, wow, why is it that the black male is consistently reduced to just a penis? His phallus, you know, what he can do in the bedroom. Why is that consistently what the black male is reduced to? And then it happens again, where son is just reduced to, wow, he sure could have some sex. Woo. Wow, that is that the totality of the, and that's where we started with son. He's a rapist. Wasn't that what they were saying about Margaret? That was his whole purpose of being. He was going to rape Margaret or Aunt Dean or somebody. Context of white supremacy. If you have commentary, if you want to comment where we ended the first audio segment about the tar baby metaphor and why that was presented by son, number to dial 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, Mr. Demi Four, Henry in Chicago should be with us. If we missed you totally, you didn't share the first time around, you have a question, comment you would like to contribute, *61, do not wait till the end. We'll make sure that we add you to the line. Good job. The person at 3098 should be with us. Proceed.
Yes, good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and participants. Hope everyone's having a great evening, a constructive evening. I wanted to speak on the tar baby metaphor. Like I said, I found it very fascinating that she actually directly referenced the fable in the text. And I found that the metaphor I presented last week is coming to fruition. I have to ponder on it a little bit more before I give a formal opinion, but I want to speak on what you also asked about. I think you were speaking about where the she spoke on the wet nurses being betrayed by their project or their care mates. I think that was last week we spoke on that, and I think that's becoming evident with the conversation that we just heard between Undine and Jadeen, where she felt that, you know, after Jadeen was raised up by her and she's coming back to get the sealskin coat, she wasn't coming back for Undine and Sydney. I think that's where the betrayal is being illustrated. And it was one other thing. I have to recall it. I can't recall it right now. But I'm meeting online to let other callers present their views. Thank you.
Much obliged, good sir. We will be done next week. So if you have commentary, you can be thinking for next week. You can write it out. You can email and we'll read online. But we are all done next Friday, last session. And you can be thinking of a new book. I was thinking 48 Laws of Power, because that has been suggested numerous times before. And boop, it's one we can cross off the list and move forward. But if you have other suggestions, feel free. Mr. Demi Four, Henry in Chicago are with us also. I'll keep an eye out if there are others who have comments to share.
Yes, can I be heard?
Mr. Demi Four.
Oh, okay. Before, I can't remember exactly where. She was having the dream, and the women were coming into the room, and the book said that those women was taking away her sex like succuba. And I looked that word up. It's a synonym for incubus. The incubus was a mystical demon that had sex with women. And so this succuba is a female demon that has sex with men while they're asleep. So, I got to thinking about Jadeen and her life. And, you know, I think it mentioned that she had a fiance in Europe, but she fell in love with Sun over here. And I think she had three suitors in Europe. And then she mentioned some of the people that she ran into in New York and some of the other places. So she seemed to be like a free spirit and not very serious about, relationships, and maybe having some problems with relationships because of abandonment issues and different things that was going on in her life. But I like the mother-daughter little dance next to the spring. Kind of brings to mind, although Ondine was not her mother, she acted as a surrogate mother for Jadeen, and they never really formed a mother-daughter relationship. And she was explaining to her, she took responsibility at this point to say that she did not teach and guide her the way that she should have, teaching her about her culture. And I guess it was evident now, clearing out, that she had no feelings whatsoever concerning the mother and daughter bond. And Ondine challenged her on being a woman concerning nourishing, being maternal, and actually being the mother of civilization, you know, the female being able to procreate. And I think that, you know, they gave a instance of some dogs and how they mate primal. And I like the little story about the soldier ants, because it's strange that she would use them because of the odd behavior of the colony run basically, I guess, by females, and then the queen bee. But soldier ants, it seems, are all over the globe, everywhere. And they have these hunting techniques, and they have these large masses that they move in. And when they attack something, they just devour it in a small amount of time. But I can't really put that together with the symbolism, what she's trying to say, but it was very interesting. And like I wanted to say before, it sounds, you know, very lightly she inserts where Valerian is stumbling over his words at first. His hands are shaking. He can't hold things. Margaret's in his room getting his clothes together like she has to dress him. And it looks like people are doing more and more things for him, like he's becoming gravely ill. I think, and Margaret still practicing racism, calling JD's hair a poodle cut. And I'll mute my line, Gus. Thank you. Technical.
Comparing us to dogs, pretty frequent. Henry in Chicago, do you have any thoughts you want to share with us?
Once again, in chapter 10, Jadeen returning back to the island, she's having this feeling of loneliness, a common theme in this book. Loneliness. What was that other one at? The interaction between Andine and Jadeen shows how much the system of white supremacy has separated us in regards to generations, older generation versus younger generation. Part of that, you know, the idea of the Willie Lynch letter of separating now white people by gender, by you know, and by age as well. So I thought that kind of stood out with that interaction between Adeem and Jadeen. And as with the previous caller, I was trying to figure out this metaphor with the ants, and I'm just assuming that, you know, that maybe some of it has to do with what has been going on with, or the vision that Jadeen had, and how thinking this might relate to this metaphor of the ant colony and the queen mother ant and the worker ant. So, if anybody has any thoughts or ideas about it, I'd love to hear it. But that's all I have right now.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Again, we are done next Thursday. We're done next Thursday. This will be our last study session on the book. So if you have any final thoughts, comments, what you think the text is about, or the metaphors, anything that you would like to share as we wrap up, all done for next Thursday. If you have any thoughts on the metaphor specifically with the soldier ants, definitely be thinking about that for next week. In fact, I think I will reserve commentary for next week about the soldier ant specifically, so that I can take a little bit more time. As I said, I was bothered. If that's going to be the final little word on Sun, and it's just about his sexual prowess, that's a little too common in the system of white supremacy as it relates to black males. I really appreciated the exchange between Jadeen and Andine towards the end of the text. I felt like that's interesting. I think it was Henry in Chicago, or not Henry in Chicago, the first male caller, when he was saying last week, I talked about the theme of Toni Morrison touching on betrayal. She was specifically in that instance talking about black females who have nourished, wet nursed, taken care of white children, and then they turn around and practice racism. So the situation with Jadeen is a little different. Jadeen and Andine But I do think that white identification, and she was talking about sending her off to all those schools and not really teaching her what it means to be a woman from her perspective. I do think that that is kind of, you end up with those white values, the white validation, where it's not really a concern. Oh, maybe I should be looking out for them. Like, I think that's what Sun has been talking about the whole time. Like, she's been more concerned and talking about Valerian than the people, really, ostensibly her parents, even though it's her aunt and uncle, Sydney and Aunt Dean, and talking about their position and trying to help them out. And even the language she was saying, I don't want to parent you right now. I thought that was interesting, almost like we're getting a different form of child abuse here with Aunt Dean. I mean, with J.D. not wanting to look out or care for Aunt Dean. Let's see. I thought... the fur coat, the line when Undine is thinking, Jadine says she came back to get her stuff, and Undine says stuff, thought Undine, meant mainly the fur coat, sealskin. She wondered if her niece would have even come to say goodbye had it not been for that sealskin coat from the white man, Rick, R-Y-K. Let's see. I thought Undine was going to call Son a nigger again. He had been called that so many times in the text, and a rapist, but she kind of stops herself, or she gets cut off by Jadine before she gets a chance to do so. I thought when they were talking about Valerian, and he's decrepit now and, you know, in poor health. He's had a stroke or whatever it is. And they're having to feed. Oh, that was such a driving Miss Daisy scene when Sydney is feeding him baked potato. I don't know if people have seen the film, but the part where Morgan Freeman is feeding Miss Daisy pie at the end of the film. Woo. But the that whole scene and Valerian has kind of let the greenhouse just deteriorate. He's allegedly so shook up about this Michael thing. Was not even believable to me. And they talked about having to clean up all of his mess. And Morrison, she says, I never knew what a clothes horse that man was, talking about Valerian. See here, Margaret fingered the garment label, silk. And here, virgin wool. Look here, 100% cotton. All his undershirts, too. He won't wear nylon or tricot. None of the man-made fibers. Everything he owns has to be made by Mother Nature. I thought that was such a slick indictment of white supremacy racism, because she had already explained in the book how he would bring over species to get rid of animals that they didn't like. And he has this greenhouse to grow all these species of plants that are not native to the island. And they made this big to-do about having apples for Christmas that do not grow on the island, and flying in all this food and what have you. And then they have the audacity to say, oh, I'm about nature. Natural fibers, natural clothes for me, when so much of their arrangement is unnatural in so many ways. The confections, the candy factory, so much of it. Anyway, I really appreciated that one as well. I have to think more on the spider metaphor at the end. I'll reread and we can wrap that for next week. But again, we're all done. We got through this book so quick. Out of here. Next Friday, 8th final session on Toni Morrison's Tar Baby, enjoyable short read, packed with racism, white supremacy. You can, if you have final comments, thoughts, any of the questions, things that have come up over the text, jot them down. Again, you can email, write them in, but we'll get all done next week. And if you have thoughts about a new book, email, send those, or you can share them next week. We should have ample time. I don't think we'll have a full audio segment next week, but we'll wrap it up. With that, much obliged to Mr. Demrick Ford, Henry in Chicago, our other caller as well, all the folks who listened and participated live or archive. I hope it's worthy of your time and energy. Reading is more important than watching television. Man, say it 2-3 times based on what we heard in the book and everything else. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. They had Jadeen, all intoxicated at the juke joint in Elo. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do everything we can to be safe under conditions designed to terrorize black people. Let's stay off the cell phone if we're going to drive. Again, just doing all the little things we can to be as safe as we can under the system of white supremacy. With that, interrupted, my bad. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.